OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Yeah, our heroes have returned from the Rugby World Cup. I don't mean the Irish rugby team. I mean Owen Sheehan. Owen, how are you? Good morning to you.
You used the word hero plural there, I think.
Yeah.
Are you talking about yourself?
I mean, I have my end up. How are you?
I'm good. It's.
I walked in this morning and went, I'm absolutely fine. I don't have any jet lag at all. And 5 minutes ago, I went, ooh, I think I've just got a little bit of delay jet lag.
Yeah, I forgot that the power of the Off The Ball Studios coffee machine brings. It kind of dispels all jet lag in return for probably drinking poison.
I had given up coffee for a long time, but I've just had a double espresso because I am absolutely wrecked.
Back on the bandwagon.
Absolutely wrecked.
I don't find it too bad. I think if you're getting up early in the morning anyway, like, I mean, my alarm went off at 1 p.m. Japanese time today. And
Happy days. So you just live on Japanese time.
There might be one or two days, especially near the end when the shackles came off, where 1 p.m. Japanese time was a common thing, especially around match days. So yeah, I'm fine. It's good. It's just an early morning. That's all.
I didn't quite realise just how late you were up filming the fan video. So what happens is the game finishes and then everybody gets back into town around midnight because there were most of our games were.
The last couple were 7 o'clocks,
And then you've got to go and find them.
Yeah.
And then you've got to go and find somewhere to edit it.
Yeah.
And then you've got to send it back.
Yeah.
And it all came back that night every time.
Every time, yeah. I was getting into a routine where it was 6 a.m. the next morning where it was getting uploaded. It was getting more and more complicated because if you have to travel around a big city to actually track people down, it's just a disaster. Whereas the first one, the one that, you know, that it just happened by accident.
The breakout.
It just happened in the train station when I was going home. I was like, God, there's nobody around here. And I think that first game was a bit earlier as well. I think that was a 4 o'clock in the afternoon kickoff. So I was done and dusted, uploaded by 2 or 3 o'clock that night, and then it became a routine.
Unfortunately, you'd set the templates and it had to happen and people demanded it. And so, like, you were finishing at 5 or 6 in the morning.
Yeah, it was 6 o'clock. So that was 10 o'clock back home. So you were getting that up. But then the worst thing was that you might have to go to an Ireland press conference.
The next day.
Yeah, but for the last couple, there was you got to lie in a
day in between.
Yeah, but sure, all you were doing is just sitting at a laptop editing. It's not like I was coal mining or anything like that. I'm not claiming to.
No, it was late, but you're missing out on what they're all doing. Or are you drinking while you're doing it?
No, not drinking while I'm doing it, for sure. They say that you should, the old cliche, write drunk, edit sober sort of thing. And if my writing is actually filming people, then I couldn't do that because I had to edit sober. So, like, there was always a temptation. And, you started to see the same faces around and you started to communicate with them a bit. And it was always like, oh, sure, you'll come for one. And you think to yourself, this is the potential to be the best night of all time. And by extension, I will do no work for the next 48 hours, let alone these vital next 3 hours. So, no, I'd say discipline on that front.
Very good. So who is your favourite?
Of the fans?
Yeah.
Well, my favourite is Gav, who was referred to as an effing bullshitter by his mate in video number one, appeared again in video number two, and then was in constant communication with their crew who was travelling around Japan, because I needed to get Gav back on again, and finally got in touch with him on the last night when he was interviewed and finally gave his one last up Cork. And it was funny. Like, the last video got a heap of negative reaction online, as things tend to get. And I don't think it was any worse than the other videos. I think if you hated the fan videos, that's fine. You can hate them all. But I think the last one just got extra hate because people, like, someone to blame. Yeah, we lost.
Yeah.
And they were like,
it's their fault.
All this anger needs to go somewhere. It's the Irish fans' fault. So I found that very funny that people would kind of refer to them as celebrating defeat, which is absolute nonsense, to be quite honest with you. They weren't cheering when Bowden Barrett is going over for a try.
No.
They get disappointed. They leave the stadium and they're like, well, that's really crap. Oh, hold on a minute. I just spent perhaps €1,200 on return flights to Japan. I'm in this amazing country. I'm on holidays. I'm actually going to go for a few drinks. And I might actually sing a few songs. But yes, they've brought shame on the nation, according to a few sad people online.
It's the local culture to sing songs.
Yeah,
exactly. You have to try and implicate yourself somehow in Japan.
Well, yeah, they just did it outside the karaoke booth rather than inside the karaoke booth.
There's about 6 separate videos on YouTube which are all entitled Owen's Final Dispatch from Japan. And there are some nice comments on them. Obviously, nobody gets nice comments on YouTube, so fair play. Oisin Quinn, I really have enjoyed Owen's reports. Great lad for the content. I mean, that's correct.
That's the nice thing that actually has ever been said about me, a great lad for the content.
That should be your Twitter bio. Maxima Horo, Owen is a lovely person. Look forward to seeing more of him in the years ahead. Excellent presentation skills he has! !!
That's super nice.
Kerry Starr, that's not you, that's the name.
No, that's my burner account.
All right, okay. Got to see the real ES over this month. Sound lad.
Yeah, I really did. Forgot to find myself.
Hiding who you are really here.
Exactly. I'm Kerry Starr.
It was only when you had Silence, Cunning and Exile that you were able to reveal the true girth of your personality.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly the word I would have used to describe my personality as well.
Rhinoceros. Okay, so it's spelled Ryan, R-Y-A-N, rhinoceros. You've been a pleasure to watch, Owen. Sure, we will see you as a commentator and opinionator, is that a word, for many more years, and I look forward to it. Stay lucky and safe travels.
Thank you very much, rhinoceros.
An opinionator.
You've the nicest rhinoceros ever.
Why do you think you had no breakout when you were just studio-based? I mean, is this like what we have to do now? You can be like broadcasting live from anywhere in the country.
I don't know. It's just because anybody could have become a great opinionator if you're based in Japan, is what I would have thought. Anybody can be a great opinionator when you've got people like Gav to interview after games, is what I would say. So, but thank you all the same, rhinoceros.
Danny B says, whatever you got paid for your Japan trip was good value. You got paid 6 million quid. What are you talking about? There was so much brilliant content. Interviews with Justin Marshall, Shane Williams, the sumo interview with John Gunning, the food reviews, the drunk fan segment, the travel reviews, the questions at press conferences. It was gave a great context to the tournament as it was going on. Cheers. Your man's also got a burner account called Danny B.
Yeah, Danny B. Then I have one called Banny D as well. So I've got a number of burners. That one in particular was my finest comment.
Obviously, somebody paid a lot of attention to it. John Gunning, that was one of my highlights. That was class.
It feels like a long time ago. I met him a couple of times since. So he was working at all the World Cup games as a photographer.
Okay.
For the Japan Times maybe. But he has his own website, Inside Sport Japan as well, kind of an English language based one. And yeah, it's interesting because at the first weekend he was the first person I met kind of give me advice on like, you know, you can actually take out more money from the cash machine. And I was like running to an ATM. He was like, you're going to be safe in this country, telling me how to get to like the Irish press conferences and stuff like that. And just really sound guy. I finally moved over there for the 2002 World Cup, or not moved over, went over as a supporter for the 2002 World Cup.
Never came
home. I was like, I like the sound of this. And never came home. And when like he was being interviewed, he was like, News Talk, Off the Ball, they were not a thing when I was living there. I've like vaguely heard of them, but yet here's this man with a big Ross Common accent who'd left the country at a time when it was a vastly different place, you know. So fascinating guy, and he was kind of in and around all the games, and I think he's going to keep going to all the games.
You should get him on before the final.
Yeah, 100%. See if he's brushed up his rugby knowledge. He'd be the first person to say he hasn't covered much rugby before. But
I mean, about the whole experience. Certainly your opening dispatches were this World Cup has not landed really locally just yet. But as time went on, it did.
Yeah. Yeah, we were like, and that was thanks to us. I really do think that game in Shizuoka did kind of transform everything. It just was noticeable after that moment that the Japanese fans were suddenly not there for this novel thing that was happening on their doorstep. They were there to watch this amazing team that existed on their doorstep, who also happened to be playing in their home tournament. So it was just a fantastic opportunity for all of them to be able to kind of go on this crest of a wave. And almost kind of as a secondary point to that, I think it was kind of proved with the amount of Irish that actually got into the stadium for Ireland against New Zealand, because the Japanese fans were actually like, no, I do want to see the All Blacks as a rugby fan, but actually my view on rugby has changed. I'm now a fan of Japanese rugby first, and then kind of a passing fan of the novelty of the All Blacks second. And that's how so many Irish people got to get their trade. So it was mad to see that escalation, and that's what it was. Like, even just kind of in a place that had never really been touched by rugby before in Hiroshima, and just to see the place kind of stand still for Japan against Samoa, and the guy behind the bar and restaurant I was in, he didn't have much English, but he had the phrase bonus point. And I was like, all right. So, like, I mean, that's kind of the extent to which it had penetrated.
The viewership figures for one of the games, was either the Ireland game or the Scotland game, was bigger than the viewership figures for the Football World Cup final in 2002. So you can imagine how big football is, huge in Japan. I mean, I don't know if there was like a Game 7 of a World Series that they decided to fly everybody over to Japan at the game. That would probably get bigger viewership figures, fair enough. But like, it was 50 million people watched it, which is a massive, massive number for, and that was before the semi-final. I haven't seen semi-final figures yet, but it clearly did have an impact.
Yeah, for sure. You mean quarter-final figures?
Quarter-final figures, yeah.
Yeah, like I'd say Japan, South Africa could have even topped that again, but that's incredible. Like, on their home turf, they had the World Cup final in 2002, a truly worldwide sport, the biggest sport in the world, and still the rugby got a bigger figure in the pool stages.
Yeah, with, like, obviously Brazil playing particularly well. So Graham Jones says, good content out there, mate. As an England supporter, it's been quite enjoyable listening to the slow, deathward spiral and machinations of Ireland rugby, mixed in with hearing about cookie Japanese foodstuffs and other eccentricities.
The deathward spiral really was something. It was like, I'm trying to think, did we start? It was Scotland, really, That was the game when we put ourselves in a position to spiral out of control.
We did.
Even before that, it was like, is Twickenham real?
There was like the fluky bounce that gave us the second, third try against Scotland. We're like, oh, look, even the bounce of the ball is going our way this time. No.
Stockdale went through for an opportunity. I think he passed it off, didn't he? And it was like, the ball is bouncing with Jacob Stockdale like it was in 2018. We are back.
Good, just going to put that last one back up there. There was another one. Some bad ones as well here. Shame on Owen Sheehan for including Sweet Caroline multiple times. Just awful. There's a reason for that, though. They play it in all the stadiums.
They do play it in all the stadiums, yes. Thank you for giving me a reason there.
The stadium experience was great crack, I have to say, as like somebody who's quite cynical about all that. There's proper karaoke, because obviously karaoke is such a big thing in Japan. They put proper karaoke up for like pre-match build-up and the whole crowd sings, because that's what they do. It's like not a, you know, if it was an Irish audience, you were putting it up muttering into there. And they also had the drums that you could play. That was class. Did you see that?
I did see that. So it was covered. It was like drum cam, and then a bongo would appear here and a bongo would appear there, and you just got to bang the bongos, really, and it was pretty self-explanatory. I thought the match experience was unbelievable. Like, it's not as far as, say, going to an NFL or an NBA game, or say, especially like the Super Bowl in terms of the theatre, but it was, I think that was kind of done deliberately because they know that perhaps traditional rugby fans might not be prepared for that, but they went as far as they could possibly do it. Every game felt like an absolutely gigantic occasion. Everything was off to a tee. Like, you've got to credit Japan for that, you've got to credit World Rugby for that, the people behind it all. It just felt huge, it felt seismic. No matter how, even the small stadium that Ireland played Samoa in, every moment felt like a World Cup game, packed stadiums everywhere. And
World Rugby did say that this isn't a once-in-a-lifetime thing, we're coming back here. Like,
they would be stupid not to.
You could see it happening in the next 20 years.
Imagine if we were like thinking to ourselves now, so 4 years' time, we're up. How are we going to follow that?
Like, you've got 4 years to do it. And also, everybody would be on the island. So there would be... It's funny, I didn't expect there to be much of a World Cup post-match feeling, but there was in certain areas. Like, everybody headed for the same areas. All the rugby fans seemed to head for the same areas after matches. Yeah. Issel Cody, good morning to you, Issel. Well, at Nathan Murph will have serious competition for awards season next year. I think Addo and Sheehan put in harder work than most teams in Japan. Some more ones that aren't very nice. Shame on Owen Sheehan. Jiren the Grey says, Owen Sheehan looks like Captain America before the super soldiers hear him. Jesus, somebody get that kid a sandwich. He had loads of food. He had loads of good food.
I did actually.
Rubbish stuff as well.
My diet was horrific.
7-Eleven chicken nuggets.
Sandwiches from 7-Eleven. That was... But, like, I mean, when you got kind of a couple of hours together and you're like, okay, I'm going to go find a nice restaurant, obviously it was pretty good, but I'm dying for a bit of fruit.
Fruit?
Fruit. I didn't eat much fruit.
Right, you got scurvy.
Yeah, might have got scurvy, but hopefully I've got enough of a vitamin C intake before I went to actually last me until my next dose of vitamin C, which is hopefully coming soon.
Yeah, maybe so that's what Captain you're looking America forward to most. That was my question next.
Fruit, probably, yeah, but fruit, like, I mean, that's it. That's the only thing I kind of missed. I was just dying for something healthy at certain moments.
Surely you'll make the shortlist for the Pulitzer with this piece, and that was on your Sheehan's sushi segment from Beppu in Japan. So, well, people are clever, aren't they? And you're now a sushi connoisseur?
I would say so.
Will you be eating sushi again?
I would say sushi connoisseurs will look up to me and my kind of performances. I shall certainly be eating sushi again, but only the best, really. The Dublin sushi scene, I know, is thriving. The Japanese food scene in Ireland is thriving. So,
it's pretty good, yeah.
That is no coincidence.
They haven't invited you around to like do a tasting kind of as a follow-up?
Not yet, but then again, you know, I am like the most honest food reviewer out there, so...
That'd be danger.
It'd be hugely dangerous, especially given my taste buds are more kind of astute than most.
All of a sudden?
No, I think you could get born with astute taste buds.
No, I think you just woke them up.
I woke them up, yes. Good point. It was all the...
The sweat.
The Pocari sweat. Pocari I actually sweat. Have a bottle of Pocari sweat in my bag today, yeah. Kind of living off that, sipping away in it.
Did you ever check what was in it? A friend of mine went to the World Cup in 2002 and came back with diabetes. So you wanted to check that you haven't just been drinking like gallons and gallons of liquid sugar. Do you think you might be?
Well, it's so unbelievably delicious that I'd be very surprised if it didn't have a humongous
it might be nothing but sugar.
Yeah, potentially, because it's gorgeous. It's like that is my Captain America super serum, Pocari Sweat.
There was, of course, another homecoming yesterday. The Irish rugby team and Joe Schmidt were at Dublin Airport. Off the ball, Shane Hannan caught up with Joe Schmidt. Have a look.
You have a rhythm, and if the rhythm works, you know, you want to keep adding, but you know, it's if you completely, not completely, but if you do change what you do, I think it's about doing it with a balance, because that rhythm is a bit of a comfort blanket for players in their preparation. And one of the things in Japan that was very difficult, I think if you have a look at the games that were played last weekend, I think the French, they win for sure if they don't get the red card. They're 19-10 up at the time, and they're outplaying Wales at the time. I think the English outplayed the Australians, the All Blacks outplayed us. Any of those teams who got the weekend off, I think it was a massive boon, and it gave them that preparation window. We flew back into Tokyo kind of late in the evening on the Monday, so we trained on the Tuesday and the Thursday, and we had a few knocks and niggles from the Samoans. That, I don't know if you've seen them up close and personal, but they hit hard, and I do think that we didn't quite have the same rhythm that the All Blacks, and that talking to their coaching staff, it was the same, and some of their players. So if you can get as much retain that really positive rhythm going into matches, I do think it makes a difference. And we changed that during the Six Nations, and we changed it because we wanted to be really good in the World Cup, and we probably would have been better off just to stay with our week-to-week focus, to live in the moment and play the tournament we were in. And if I had my time over, I'd probably change that.
Okay, we'll talk about that in a minute. Here's what's coming up. Going to do the sports pages now. Going to talk football with Damien Delaney around about 8:05. Spurs are back. Never doubted them. Or are they? That's the first question we'll be asking. Loads more to get our teeth stuck into. If you have any questions for him about last night's football, or indeed tonight's football, or any of the other stories that are happening, you can hit us up on the hashtag OTBM. It's 7:47 this morning. Mike Tindall's going to join us at 8:30, talking more about World Cup, obviously. Sports news with Phil around about 9:05. And then Phil's picks at 9:15. You can tweet us using the hashtag OTBM. We are, of course, OTBM, Off The Ball Sports Breakfast Show, and we're with you every morning from 7:30 until 9:30 across a multitude of platforms. Best place to get us these days as a radio show is just on the Go Loud app. You can get us, of course, in video form on youtube.com/offtheball. Time for the papers. I'm going to start with the Star, and the back page headline here is Top Potch. Rhymes with notch. Spurs show backing for boss by blasting 5. So a 5-star performance last night. Parrott gets 4. Troy Parrott's 4-goal haul inspired Spurs to a 9-2 romp in yesterday's UEFA Youth League defeat of Red Star Belgrade. And grand slam for Michal, still looking great. Twins Owen and Liam Wilkinson proudly display their trophy with their granddad, retired GA broadcasting legend Michal Omar-Hartig. The 89-year-old was at Croke Park to watch the talented duo help Gaelic goal Brian Barova Swords to see off St Bridget's in Colchester. And then it says here Joe Schmidt hits back. He was asked about evolution. He was heavily criticised in the wake of Saturday's defeat and has been accused of making Ireland an easy target when the serious business began. I dispute those comments massively. We created plenty of chances. Even in the Six Nations, we scored more tries than the winner. We didn't play as well as we could. I have to take responsibility for that. If I have my time over, I might do it a little bit differently.
I don't know. Darcy's making the point, Gordon Darcy in the Irish Times today, that because they lost that first game so comprehensively in the Six Nations, that just completely destroyed the opportunity for more experimentation.
It didn't, though. Like, if you've decided you're going to use the whole tournament to experiment, the defeat in the first game actually means you should do more experimentation because the competition's over. Mm. You're not going to win now that you've lost at home against England. The Grand Slam is gone, Triple Crown is gone, more than likely the tournament is gone. So experiment away, because you now literally have nothing else to lose. You've just been hockeyed. What's to lose? It's actually the opposite of
public face,
but
opinion.
We didn't get it back. Like, anyway. And there's another Paul Lennon story here about the FAI may not be able to appoint a new CEO until next May or June as the crisis-ridden organisation's reform strategy becomes a saga. They had hoped to have a permanent successor in place during the first few months of next year, but it might be until the middle of the year. It doesn't say. It's down to the fact that the new four new independent FAI directors who are due to join the board won't happen until December, because it was supposed to happen 10 days ago. Those were certainly, they were supposed to be announced, but there's been another delay. I don't know what that the current delay is, but it's not great.
Just on that Troy Parrott story, he's starting to look like David Clifford in a second year minor at this point, where he's definitely kind of grown beyond his age grade and is just looking like the big kid now, where people really just can't handle him. Unbelievable. His goals are up online, I think, if anybody wants to check them out. A back page of The Sun is Sonny and Stair. That is Tab of the Morning to you. They lead way as City and Spurs both hit five. So Sterling bagging a City hat-trick. Spurs Sun doubling up as the Prem sides ran riot last night. And that's The Sun for you.
I hadn't realised Kieran Kingston has his backroom team completed at this stage. Listen to this. Pat Mulcahy, a much beloved Cork defender from that team. Brian Corcoran, an absolute legend. And Chrissy O'Connor. That's not a bad team.
Mm.
Cork are coming. I would be concerned about the Cork hurlers if I was heard of any of the other counties. I think they're absolutely coming. We'll get more on that FAI story for you a little bit later on. I Got It Wrong is the simple back page headline on the Daily Mail about the homecoming. And so James Murray has the piece here. Maybe we built it into something that became a self-consuming monster. We didn't play as well as we could. I've got to take responsibility for that. And look, you know, it'd be nice to hear a full sit-down, hour-long, explain in detail how you got it wrong. But it would be more important for the IRFU to have that debrief and go back and see exactly what you could do differently.
Yeah, like I think, if we really do reflect on the Joe Schmidt era as the greatest head coach that Ireland have ever seen, then really to follow that through, and I said it before, to the final conclusion of that is really you judge this extremely harshly. I think if you really want to make a success of the Joe Schmidt era, you've got to really focus in on how he failed so desperately at the end of his era, because he got us to a point where getting hammered by the All Blacks is unacceptable.
Yeah.
Getting hammered by the All Blacks was previously an acceptable result in Irish rugby. So if we do really think that Joe Schmidt took us to this place, then this needs to be seen as, to a point, to a bit of a travesty that it was that last weekend in terms of the Irish performance, in terms of the underperformance, and in terms of what 2019 has been. The back page of the Mirror is Route of This World, Kane and Sterling go goal crazy, and watching brief, Joe Schmidt looking forward to enjoying his rugby again in front of the TV with a glass in his hand.
The back page of The Guardian is the Spurs players celebrating. Son and Kane carve Red Star apart as Spurs belatedly breathe life into their season with flowing 5-0 Champions League display. Bear in mind, Red Star Belgrade have been really appalling away from home in recent years, so we'll see exactly what the crack is. And then, I mean, it's kind of a nothing story midweek. Spies are watching England, says Jones. So the England team have Prince Harry's former security detail running security for them. I didn't see very heavy Irish security around. Don't know, sorry, I wasn't around the team, so maybe they did have. But apparently, they spotted a red light in a tower block overlooking the training pitch. And that's a suggestion that they were being spied on. It could just have been a Japanese fan, said Eddie Jones. But really, is the implication that it was a Japanese fan? Or is this an implication that something more sinister is going on? That the terrorised New Zealand rugby architecture, the apparatus, is somehow going to get their hands on this tape? That's really the undercurrent here, isn't it?
Well,
because they desperately need to know what England are doing in training this week that's going to be different from anything that England have put down on tape.
Before we bury Eddie Jones here, there's a great opportunity for us to use this as an excuse for Ireland. So according to, it's also on the back page of the London Times this morning, I should say, New Zealand spying on us, says England. So England's base this week, ARC's Uriyasu Park in Tokyo Bay, is the most exposed of any day of use this World Cup, with 20-storey apartment blocks rising high above the purple and white privacy tarpaulin that surrounds the pitch. Uriyasu Park, do you want to have a guess at what team trained there in the build-up to playing the All Blacks recently?
Ireland. Oh.
Were Ireland being spied on in the most open training ground that exists in Japan? That's all I'm saying.
They knew how to crush us from the get-go.
They knew how to crush us from the get-go. Joe Schmidt was spied on.
We had a new move off the very first play.
Yeah, and they knew exactly how to defend us. It was actually almost as if they just stood still and just absorbed it like a sponge. But no, it was down to the spying. Ireland were spied on, fact.
Yeah, yeah. What about the sleeper cell of South African rugby that we had living with us for the previous time when Razzie and Felix Jones were actually working for Ireland?
Well, that's the thing.
That worked out really well.
That's why I fully believe that had that sleeper cell got to put their plan in action against Ireland on Sunday,
They might have crushed us.
By an even bigger margin.
Ah, no, not a bigger margin. It couldn't be bigger. It was a record.
It really could be, though.
Oh, Telegraph. We've been spied on, say England. Eddie Jones ramping up the mind games in the build-up to their game this weekend. Oh, how I wish we had some mind games to be ramping up. And high five, it's Harry Kane. He's back. And how Chelsea owner spends his days apart from the club he loves. This is a headline about Roman Abramovich, who, of course, I think still isn't allowed in, or is he? Did he get access?
Don't think so. Mm. I think he's somewhere down in Croatia at the moment.
He's exiled. He's on the boat. He's on the Succession boat. Is anybody watching? Are you watching Succession?
No, I am going to get into it, though.
Oh, it's sensational. There's, like, the final episode has this massive, giant boat, which is, like, it looks like it must be the most expensive boat in the world, because there can't be anything that's bigger, that's privately owned. Like, it's big. It's as big as, like, a naval ship. And Roman Abramovich has one, too.
The Irish Times leads with Gordon Darcy's column. To get up off the floor, Ireland must dig deep into what went wrong. So he wonders, with absolutely no insight to the inner workings, he admits, of a tight-knit group, did they become too close? Can there be free commentary between peers if the working relationship is blurred by friendship? So, sliding doors, this is something that perhaps you brought up before as well. Joey does not leave Leinster. Joey Carberry doesn't leave Leinster. This is a kind of potential hypothetical from Gordon Darcy. So Stuart Lancaster conjures up an attacking strategy that was less about numbers on backs and more about ensuring Sexton and Carberry keep defences guessing. So basically Joey Carberry at 15. Joe Schmidt, it provides so irresistible that he adds to his creative spark to the new dual threat, and Ireland's attack becomes as unpredictable as it is deadly. That could have been the impetus for Joe Schmidt to actually transform or come up with a better game plan or kind of an alternative game plan this year, if he could have seen something in his own provinces that was doing the trick.
Right. I mean, that was exactly what Leinster wanted at the time. They wanted him to stay. And they could have put him in the team straight away. Like, there would have been ample opportunity for us to try this. We got to the point where we tried Robbie Henshaw at fullback, who hasn't played fullback since his Connacht days, and even then it was very rare that he was playing compared to the amount of times that he played centre. So they clearly wanted to give themselves an option of somebody else as a receiver, but we never once looked at that in an Ireland context, even though Leinster, who, bear in mind, had Stuart Lancaster, who's clearly a brilliant coach, saying this is what we should be doing here, we should be trying this out, and we didn't listen to the coaches. Like, I think part of the problem is as well that you have this top-down system where the people who have access day-to-day to the Ireland players, their opinion, I'm sure it's listened to, but it wasn't acted on in this particular instance where, you know, Leinster had created this player and saw a future for him and wanted to create something which would be very different from what we have. And Ireland went, no, we just need another 10. We're going to do this. And we've decided this is what's going to happen.
Carberry wanted to be a 10 as well, though, didn't he?
But, like, I mean, he says that, right?
If he's playing like Beauden Barrett, though, he probably wants to be a 15. And
well, like, I'd say Beauden Barrett probably wants to be a 10.
Yeah. But he also wants to be a World Cup winner and he wants to be part of the best attack in the world. So I did get the sense, though, from Carberry, though, like, that there is a clear hierarchy in terms of his love for rugby connected to his position. Like, almost scoffing at the idea of being a scrum half or a 12 when it was brought up.
Who?
Over the course of the World Cup. Carberry himself. Like, I mean, because he was essentially the sub-scrum half for what game was it? The Russia game?
Yeah.
When Murray was out, I think. So, like, I just think that when it comes
to... But at the time, right?
Okay, so at the time it's different.
Yeah, at the
because
time...
Because he's found his love for 10 this year as well, let's,
like,
not forget.
Yeah, and, I mean, The track record of Irish players who were centres who became wingers, or who were wingers who became centres, were like, well, no, I'm playing this specific position because that's what, like, I won something at some underage level. And then 15 caps in, they're like, I'm actually world class in this position. This is great. So, like, the need of the player and the need of the national team can sometimes not be aligned. I don't know. I think it's an excellent point, and I think it's the type of thing that now we're never going to see, because that moment has passed. But we're not a country that has ever really had and taken the two great tens that we have and put them in the team together to see what happens. Every other country in the world has tried this, and frequently they've either used it for a long period of time or they've had it in their back pocket when they need it.
And we're going to see it in full flow this weekend. Ford and Farrell up against Moonga and Barrett, and Sexton and Carberry potentially could have been an unbelievable option for Ireland. Like, that could have been... The question might not have been Joe Schmidt identifying that Sexton was coming off his peak, and therefore perhaps removing him or taking minutes back and kind of replacing him. The identification would have been that he needs help in his backline. We need to reinvent Sexton coming off his World Player of the Year, calendar year. We need to actually transform his game a little bit or give him a bit more help, because not only have Ireland put themselves in the crosshairs to be figured out by everybody as the best team in the world in 2018, there's also individuals have put themselves into the crosshairs. Jonathan Sexton is target number one because he is World Rugby Player of the Year. So, like, all of this is just so easy to say in hindsight, but it is definitely a lesson for the future. It is definitely a lesson that if Ireland gets themselves into a position 1 or 2 years out from a World Cup where they look like world beaters, that is just so far away from the summit when it comes to success in the biggest tournament of all.
Yeah, I think, though, the key thing is that you've got multiple ways of doing things, that you're not just a single prototype of play. And it was interesting over the course of the tournament that Schmidt was asked about what's his philosophy. And his philosophy is to try and win games. Essentially, he was like, I don't have a philosophy. I respond to what the opposition are going to do and I build a game plan that's going to beat them, which is like what some of the greatest coaches in any sport in history have always done. They've been able to beat you whatever way you were going to... Because most teams aren't evolved to the point that they can do a variation of things to you. Most teams have a very simple, we've got these good players, we're going to use those good players to do the things they're best at, and we're going to defend like hell. In any sport, that tends to be what happens. But the great teams and the great coaches are like, well, if you do that, I'm going to just attack your weakness. And I know how to do that because I've given all of my players all of the available information that they are required to make decisions in a short space of time that are going to allow them to do that. We didn't seem to get to that point, really. We seemed to actually have a style. Like, despite what he said, we did seem to have a very specific way of playing that required us to win collisions and that required us to have high-intensity pressure and great line speed. And if any element of that was missing, we lost games. And when the form disappeared, we lost a load of games. So I think that the key lesson is to make sure that you've got multiple styles of play and that you're able to go into them. And that if we were, like, you know, at one stage it looked like we might be about to try Carberry in the centre over the course of the tournament, and then it didn't happen. You're like, well, I mean, I wouldn't have been against it. I just think that we could have tried it 18 months ago. We could have tried it last year. We could have tried it at Leinster for a season and gone, let's see how this works.
Yeah, like, if you're going to have control over the provinces,
what's the point of it?
Yeah, at least have that control in terms of...
Especially when they want to do it.
Tactically influencing, yeah.
And they're saying to you, look, we think he's actually a fullback. Let's do this.
But is that the light we need to be looking at now in terms of 2023? The guy who... I don't want to give Stuart Lancaster too much credit here. He's not the guy who identified Carberry as a potential 15. I'm sure that there was other coaches who said it. Like, Graham Henry spotted him as an ex-potential world-class player. But the cohort within Leinster that exists as potential future Ireland coaches is one in two men. It's like Leo Cullen and Stuart Lancaster. Like, should there not be some sort of succession plan put in place right now that, with a view to 2023, if Andy Farrell is a success, you're getting the band back together, you're getting Farrell and Lancaster back together. And if Andy Farrell is a disaster, you've got Stuart Lancaster lined up as your next Ireland head coach. That, like, Farrell gets a 2-year stay of execution no matter what goes wrong, because I think he probably deserves that, because the part of me kind of feels a little bit of sympathy for him picking up the pieces now. Granted, his defence got absolutely slaughtered last weekend, to perhaps try something new. If he's trying new things over the next 2 years, I think Ireland fans will give him a bit of forgiveness.
He's got a clean slate, really, I think. As a head coach, he's got a clean slate. It wasn't his team, it wasn't his philosophy, it wasn't his training style. He was a defence coach, and granted, they had a really bad day, but like, they've had good days in the past. So,
but Stuart Lancaster is the best coach on the island of Ireland, working in the island of Ireland right now. Like, I really believe that. Why they would not perhaps be looking at him now, thinking next World Cup, France, he could potentially be involved in the Ireland
setup. Well, because he could get a head coach job in the meantime.
And then it's up to us to ensure that is preempted and that we see that coming. Like, we miss a lot of things coming in this World Cup. Let's not make the same mistakes. And when it comes to personnel, let's not make the same mistakes. Losing Razzy Erasmus was kind of an uncontrollable because he's South African.
He was
always going
to go back,
patriotic call to arms. England aren't coming back for Lancaster.
Things you've missed, Owen, while you were away? Have you heard of a kid called Aaron Connolly?
I've heard just about him, yeah. I was actually on live with Nathan when he scored his brace against Spurs. And they do this thing on the Saturday show now where they... Play some music whenever an Irish person scored. So there was a lot of tunes going. I can't remember where he was, but
what were the tunes?
I can't even remember now.
Supermax and Pat McDonough kicked up a bit of a storm in Galway.
Heard about this.
A couple of statements.
I saw one of the statements.
A few broadsides fired at the county board.
The beef is real, I guess you could say, because Supermax beef is real as well.
Hey.
Use that line?
No, and you're the first one.
Oh, jeez.
I can't believe it. We've missed you, Owen.
It's straight, doesn't get frozen.
A bit of trouble in Mayo, which has a cast of characters that has now extended to Mike Ashley, maybe or maybe not.
Okay, you're going to have to explain this one to me.
Well, I don't know them. I don't fully understand it myself. There's a brilliant documentary to be done by somebody out there on this guy who is bankrolling Mayo at the minute. He's got a colourful past and he's got loads of money. And
Tim O'Leary, it's been said into my ear.
And it's worth doing a bit of digging about and just Google him. He's got a very interesting story, and I think what the hell's going to happen in Mayo is going to be one of the great off season. It's going to be up Holmes and Kennelly esque the off season in terms of like the amount of stuff that we hear about Mayo football over the next 4 or 5 months.
Funny how Mayo and Galway tend to get themselves into these situations. Are we expecting an Elvery's statement over the next couple of weeks?
Is it on Galway's level?
I think
they should be happy enough with how things are being run. I don't know if they are or not. Like I would, because they're the situ sponsor, and it's obviously a great sponsorship deal for them. So, a shoe broke through the 2-hour marathon records.
Yeah, I heard about this as well.
The magic shoes.
Yeah.
We all celebrated. Oh, how we celebrated! Tremendous feat of engineering.
And Salazar got banned.
Salazar got banned. Yeah.
And a load of people couldn't finish the marathon in Doha.
It was a bit hot.
Very hot.
They moved the Tokyo Marathon for the Olympics as well because it's the middle of stuff. Aidan Goff says, you missed Owen Merchant, but so did every other carryman.
It's way too raw.
Where did you watch the game?
Missed the first 20 minutes because I had to get back to my Airbnb because the bar, Geronimo's Shot Bar in Roppongi, believe it or not, was not a great sports bar.
Right.
Who'd have thought it?
Yeah.
Geronimo Shot Bar, fool me once and all that sort of thing. So I did get approached by somebody saying you were bad-mouthing my bar a couple of days ago. This was like at the end of the World Cup and I was bad-mouthing Geronimo Shot Bar at the start of the World Cup.
Right.
So they don't forget in Geronimo Shot Bar if you slag off their sporting facilities. But there was a GEA Go stream that was buffering terribly, so I just went home.
What else have you missed since you've been away since September the 12th? What are we at now? The 23rd of October. That was a nice trip. If you think anything that Owen has missed, tweet us here at Off the Ball with hashtag OTBAM. Jimmy McCullough says the old team are back. Get in. I meant Ger and Owen as opposed to the rugby team. Finally, Den and Angie, Jack and Vera, Seve and Ole, and Kilban and Mora. Normality has returned. Owen is back. No offence, fill-ins.
Says
Jonathan Kennedy.
That is.
Morning, Johnny.
Morning, Jonathan. That is another thing I've missed. Kilban on ice.
Hasn't started yet.
Hasn't started. Okay, good.
You should follow his Instagram account, though, because he made it public recently enough. He's all about those Instagram likes now.
So Maguire the dog has been replaced by a pair of skates.
Maguire's the star of the show. Yeah. Right, competition time. All this week on OTBAM, we're giving you the opportunity to win UEFA Champions League quarterfinal tickets with thanks to Pepsi Max, one of the proud sponsors of the UEFA Champions League. Every entry this week gets entered into Friday's final draw, but we also have Pepsi promotional packs up for grabs for our daily winners on OTBAM. To be with the chance of winning this morning, share the show wherever you're watching and listening and name all the Irish footballers, all of them, with a Champions League medal since the 1990s. Are there five? Is that what we said? Maybe there's six. Just a reminder, if you don't win, six I think, if you don't win on OTBAM this week, there are more ways to win with Pepsi Max. With more than 20 tickets up for grabs for games in the Champions League group stages, just check out pepsimax.ie for more. We're back talking football after these. OTBAM.
At the time, I wasn't working. I was still trying to figure it all out. So that definitely gave a distraction as well as keep me in top shape and whatever it was. So to dive straight in was really good for me, and exactly as you said, it kept the mind occupied and it helped me into the summer.
Was that the biggest obstacle to coming home? Because, you know, we hear of a lot of kids, a lot of Irish kids who go over to English clubs or go elsewhere, and the biggest thing is I guess it's that little shortfall in the immediate days, weeks and months after, you know, you either get released or you move on to another club or things move on in your life in a different direction entirely. It's that first step out seems to be the most crucial, and if you don't have the right people around you, if you don't have the right systems around you, if you don't have, you know, good family looking after you, even something as simple as that, then it can go haywire. But you seem to have looked out on that front.
Yeah, definitely. That was the hardest part for me, was definitely coming home and settling for that 3-4 month period where I didn't know exactly what I was going to be doing. And thankfully, I had good people around me, people within the GAA clubs, Waterford County Board, managers, whatever it was. So that was really important for me. But as you said, it can kind of go one way or another for people. And thankfully, mine, I was straight into keep myself occupied and playing what I love, I suppose.
The full podcast is available for you to download on the Go Loud app, or indeed wherever it is you get your podcasts, offtheball.com/podcast. It's 8:11. You're watching OTB AM this morning, probably on YouTube or listening to us on the Go Loud app. Damien Delaney is in studio with us. Good morning to you, Damien. How are you doing?
Morning, lads. How are you?
You were at Waterford, I think, when he came back from Brighton.
Yeah, Desi came in and trained with us for a couple of days. But the lads, he pretty much openly said that he was kind of fallen in love with football, and it probably wasn't for him. I think Adam Reynolds probably forced him to come in and train, trying to reignite his passion for it, because, you know, obviously he's a local lad. But I think he openly said his first morning that he was probably going to go back and play GAA. So he trained with us for a couple of days, and obviously went back and played GAA and has done ever so well this year.
That's a real pity that happens to players who go off and are making it, who've like somehow managed to be filtered through. They're the little nuggets of gold that make it out of Ireland all the way over to England, and then the situation is so bad for them they fall out of love. Is there anything we can do as a football coach?
I touched on this a little bit last night. I think that's where the League of Ireland should be kind of aiming all their artillery, really, is catching these kids coming back. Everyone always says, like, can we stop these kids going over, or, you know, if we improve the league, you know. It's the ones that come back, I think, you know, if you can create an environment for them that can reignite their love of the game, that can reignite their passion, there's a market there from a business point of view of the clubs, because you can always sell them back over again, you know. Yeah. But you need to give them a good home when they come back to. But I can understand the kids kind of hyped up their whole lives all the way to 19, 20. I'm going to be football. Then all of a sudden, that road in the UK is closed for them. They come back to Ireland and there's almost kind of this, you know, the sigh. And you could see it in Desi, and he felt a little bit like that. Whereas what I'm getting at here is training facilities, pitches, stadiums, just the whole League of Ireland having a rejig, that when these guys come back, they might discover the reason why they wanted to go and play professional football in the first place.
Is there a management thing? Is there like, because I don't know if this is exactly what Owen Hand was doing back in the day. He kind of had a career guidance role, and there was certainly a bit of research done in DCU by a player who'd gone away and come back, and they found that, like, it was almost putting some kind of, not just the physical architecture, but like a mental architecture to as you say, reignite that thing. But I wonder, is there a role for the FAI at a central level, kind of a database of players who...
I know there's probably people out there screaming, oh, we're doing everything we can, you know, but I lived that, and so far as when I left the UK, I came back, and I came back in a totally different mindset to what Desi came back at, so I knew what I was getting into. But I could imagine that if I was 19, 20 and I came back to it, you might be a little bit like, you know, I want a little bit more, because you're used to certain standards. Now, it's never going to be the same as what he had at Brighton or what I had, but it needs to be better for them lads to come back, you know?
Okay. Obviously, the Champions League was on last night. You were in studio with Richie, and is the consensus Spurs are back and that's it?
No, not far from it.
It's all finished.
No. Far, far, far from it. I wouldn't read too much into that Spurs result. I commented last night, that Red Star team, it was almost like someone told them that it was shadow play. Right. I mean, they were so passive in everything that they did. I don't think I've ever seen a team. It was almost like a run-through on a Friday morning where one team attacks and the other team has the ball, and the opposition basically just told, just be live but no contact. And that's what it looked like last night, and that is right up Spurs' alley. That's just what they want, so they can get their passing going and everything. So far from it. I think, you know, the cracks that are there are only cracks that are going to be magnified when, like, say for instance last night, they were 2-0 up and Red Star scored to make it 2-1, and all of a sudden the Red Star's tails are up, then you'll see the cracks come through. But they were never challenged last night.
Can a victory like this, even against inferior opposition, can it be the spark for a team that has the quality that Spurs have?
No. because there's a lot of underlying problems there. You know, the problem isn't a technical or a tactical one. It's clearly off-field issues that they have going on there.
Yeah, because I was listening to you and Richie in the build-up, and essentially it's about money, right?
Yeah.
And it reaches a point where they're so annoyed with the business model that they're all... It's not that they're downing tools, but they're thinking about it.
They haven't done tools. You just lose your edge a little bit. You know, that 1-2%, where all of a sudden you're really upset and you're coming to work every day and you've been made promises. I'm presuming that's what's gone on. Pochettino, I think, is probably the one that's most upset for his players, not with his players, because I think he's probably as upset with Daniel Levy as what the players are. Because as a manager, you want to get the most out of your players, and your players are going through brick walls for you every day, which is what they did for the last couple of years. And they're not being rewarded. And not only that, then nobody's coming in terms of, you know, to make that next step to win the league. Because, you know, regardless of what you may think, top players want to see top players come in their club, because then it kind of lifts them a little bit, like, oh my God, we're serious here. We want to win a league. You know, if Spurs went and spent 200 million over the summer and went, right, listen, we're nearly there and we're going to get there, that's what top players want to see.
There is going to be a time, though, when Pochettino will have to get over that himself, or somebody will have to get over it themselves. Like, they're not all going to leave at the one time. It's not going to be a situation where the manager and the players go, are we starting to see that already, like Alderweireld and Eriksen dropped last night?
Yeah, I think they're planning for that already. I think Daniel Levy has done what he does, and that is, you know, tie players down. Like, you look at all the young players, I suppose, I'll get 6-year deals. And that's precisely that he does not, in case any one of them comes through, he does not want to lose them on a free. I mean, it is a business model that has worked for him. But I think Pochettino looked fed up last night, even a 5-0 up every time the camera cut to him, because he was probably made promises as well. You know, if you get to the Champions League, if you get us to the final, you know, I'll give you. And then when Daniel Levy doesn't deliver, as any human being would do in any job, when your boss makes your promises and doesn't follow through on them, you lose a little bit of interest. You know, I know Spurs fans and people think, oh well, they get paid enough money, but
They don't. Compared to their...
Which is where I was going with it. Like, you know, I mean, your work puts you in a certain pay bracket, and if you're not getting paid what you think you should be, or what your work has kind of decided you should, then you're going to lose a little bit. Especially if the team up the road is willing to pay you, you're going to be a little bit upset, you know?
And presumably they're hearing how much they're being offered. Like, the agents are going, I've got you a great deal from Man United, I've got you a great deal from whoever.
Right, this deal's on the table, we need to get you out. And then the agent is probably telling the player, look, you need to start causing mayhem in the training ground, so they get so upset they'll sell you. But Daniel Levy looks at the kind of fellow, goes, well, I don't care, I'd rather lose you on a free than sell you for 10 million quid in the summer, a year short of your contract, which is probably what he's done to Christian Eriksen. Maybe not 10 million, but, you know, if he's got a year to run in his contract. Alderweireld the same, I think, you know, teams probably offer 10, 15 million for him.
That bit of business doesn't make that much sense to me, that they should have cashed in on Eriksen before losing him for nothing. I mean, if I'm Eriksen, I actually think that it's a much better thing to play out your contract.
But see, he's getting to an age now where he's 29, 30. If he doesn't play this season and he gets to the summer, he's not quite as hot as what he was last summer. And teams are kind of going, well, you know, that offer was there. You know, you haven't played much this year, you know, 30, you know.
So if I was Eriksen's agent at the start of this last year of his contract, I would say, once the move doesn't happen in the summer, put your head down, get in the team, play well, and we will get you all the money that was going to go to Spurs in the transfer. We're going to put that in your bank account.
Right, but he probably is putting his head down and trying to play well, but he's obviously mentally been disturbed now, where he just thinks, you know, and you lose that edge, you know, it doesn't take much. If you come off at 1-2% of that level, it does show up, and he probably is trying, but if his heart's not in it, I don't care what you do, you cannot play to the level these guys play at if your heart's not in it.
Is he scared of injury?
No, definitely not. It's just his heart's not in it.
But is the motivation now not... there's this thing in American sports where you're in a contract year, everybody knows it's the final year of your contract, and traditionally, players outperform their mean over the last four or five years by massive amounts and get these superstar deals, and then they relax and they're actually not very good after a year or two.
Right, well, I think there's probably an element of what we know, end of October, 2 months to January. There's probably an element now where Daniel Levy will cut his losses and say, just someone give me 8 million quid for him, or 10 million, or 50, whatever they can get for him in January. Because I could imagine that he will now see that he's pushed it too far and he's crossed the line, we'll get something back from him. Otherwise, because if he starts trying now, they might go, do you know what, we'll keep him till the summer and we will. You know, that's where that kind of goes, you know.
It's a high wire act.
It is, definitely.
It seems like a kind of a huge debate that has to be had about Daniel Levy then, because I think before this, you could say that every business move he's made has been fairly shrewd. Mm-hmm. Like, it seems like a fairly glaring error of basic of economics here that he would allow this to happen. Yeah. Like, I mean, January seems like it makes a bit of sense, but ultimately the way he's been thinking about this, you wouldn't be surprised to see it go on a bit longer.
I think he's just backed himself into a corner a little bit, and I think they probably overachieved, but getting to a Champions League final just like heightened all these players' value and their worth. And the thing is, if they were 21, 22, 23, I take your point on board, they just kill it for a year. They're all approaching 30. Yeah. Right, so it's kind of like, once you get to 30 in the modern game now, I mean, I spoke to some people over and they said that, like, nobody wants to sign 28-year-olds.
Because there's no resale value.
There's no resale value, and unfortunately, the way the modern game has gone, it's so high-paced, fast-actioned. The 28 is, unless you're a really, really good technical player, everyone just wants legs now. Legs, run. You watch the pace of these Champions League games. They're all 21, 22, 23 years of age when they can just rattle off these 50 games a season, no problem, go away and have a week off in the summer and they come back. You can only do that for so long. As soon as you get to 26, there will be a slight drop-off.
That's very interesting. And, like, is there a situation now where perhaps you can go away for 1 or 2 years, play in a different style of play and come back and have a rejuvenated career at the age of 30? Because, like, I mean, that's clearly a worry for any young footballer who's starting off now then, if you're thinking that you've got to burn yourself out up until the age of 28.
Possibly. I mean, I'm not sure you can go off and play a different style of football because you'd have to reinvent yourself completely. You know, you'd want to be like
a lower paced league or something.
Right, maybe that's the thing. But I'm just talking to these top level teams now, Tottenham, Man City. I mean, all you have to do is look at their physical. I mean, I don't know if you can get at their physical data after games is unbelievable. The distances they're covering, not just the distance they're covering, they have this thing called high intensity, which is
number of sprints.
Yeah, which is 7.5 meters a second. That's a sprint. And I think that even in my last year, some of our midfield players were doing like 1,500 metres at 7.5 metres a second. I mean, that is flat out sprinting for 1,500 metres and covering 13k in a game. So it does take a toll, not to mention your training loads during the week, you know.
Do you remember what those figures might have been when you were starting out or when those figures started?
Oh, I don't even think they were there.
Right.
No, it was all done by the eye.
Right.
I think that's how it was. But I just think the last year, my last number of years, I mean, everything was everything. They could tell you how long you stood still for in a training session.
Are all the managers embracing this and using it? Cause
I don't think, they're not using it as like the gold standard, right? I mean, there's a little bit of, you can just go and run around the corner flag for you know what I'm saying? You have to marry it up a little bit. Like, if you're effective in what you're doing, and when a manager watches a game back and he sees the stats and he sees your performance, if he can marry those two up, then obviously, you know, he's happy. But if players' numbers are down, they will ask the question, is he tired? Because it is a sign of fatigue. So if your training loads are always at a certain thing and all of a sudden they're down 20%, you will get called in and saying, is everything okay? Have you been unwell? Is there a reason that it's down? Are you conserving energy? Or are you tired? You know, and they work. It's not done in terms of, I think a lot of people, when they hear these stats things, they go, oh, you don't want to be cheating. It's not. I mean, if your numbers are down, you know, you don't make it that level if you're dishonest, right? That dishonesty, you get found out at 18 years of age, right? So if your numbers are down, they will call you in. They want to know why. Have you got a virus? Or they might check your bloods. Or is there something up with you? Do you need a week off? Will we pull you from the team? So sometimes that's kind of where that goes, you know?
Is being pulled from the team a terrorising thing for players because of the quality of competition in squads now, where you're very scared about not getting your place back?
Yeah, definitely. But that's where it should be. Because then that might stop you getting tired. So then maybe your numbers aren't down because you're just coming in every morning on pure fear. Like, I can't have an off day today. I can't. Yeah. You know. Because, I mean, I remember at my club, the following morning, on the notice board in the hallway, all the training stats were put up.
For everybody?
Yeah, everybody's were put up.
Right.
So you can come in the morning and you would see people looking at it, you know. And obviously, if your recovery days on a Monday and your Tuesday will be a work day, Wednesday you're off, depending on what way your team breaks up the week or whatever, you know, so they have certain, I mean, they can tell you now, your training session, they'll tell you the numbers you're going to hit in it, you know.
In advance.
And even my last year, there's a sports analyst with a laptop on the side of the thing and with live data. And I've seen the analysts.
Why, you know, delay?
No, the opposite. I've seen the analysts call the manager over and say, look, we've hit our numbers.
Right.
And the manager will be like, right, we're done, everyone in.
Right.
Jesus.
Because you're saying that you want to be right for Saturday at 3 o'clock.
proper load management.
Right, so you want to go, okay, what gets us in the best possible shape Saturday at 3 o'clock?
And can I ask you, did it ever fail where you'd done the numbers, everybody thinks, oh, we've had a great week in training, and then flat as a pancake, 3 o'clock Saturday afternoon?
But then they'll mix it up then the following week, because they'll go, okay, they'll look, I mean, the coaching staff will go back and they'll look and they'll say, why were they flat on the weekend? It was, they look back over all the data and they'll see for markers, possibilities, you know, another thing they use it for is injury prevention. You know, if a player is hitting certain loads or his heart rate's going to certain zones, and then say he did that last season for 3 weeks in a row and he picked up a hamstring injury, they'll flag that and they'll say, look, you're starting to get, you know. Now, some players really do listen to those, you know, if a coach says, look, we're going to pull you from training today, we're going to modify your session, whereas other players are going, get that out of my face, I'm going to training today, right?
Yeah.
So it's a balancing act. Like I said, it's not the gold standard. It's not what everyone lives off of, but it, good coaches will use it for what it's worth. Yeah.
Did you ever find a common theme for a flat performance? Because it's such a cliche and there's often such a mystified nature about it when managers come out in the aftermath, like, we're flat. I don't actually know why we were flat. Did you ever find that there was a scientific reason?
Yeah, I remember one time we had, under Alan Pardew, he mixed the week up in a really funny way where we were like off Sunday, in Monday, off Tuesday, and then the 3 day lead in for the game,
right.
And we had a couple of really good results doing it and everything was going great. Then all of a sudden he just stuck to the 3 day lead in, and a lot of players were going and saying, look, you know, Wednesday's a work day, high training load, and then it was tapering down Thursday, Friday. And I think some of the players ended up going to him and saying, look, Gaffer, you know, I mean, we do feel a touch leggy in the warm up, you know, can we mix it up? And he wouldn't mix it up. He was like, no, this is, you know, we're happy with this. Now, he had his reasons for that, I don't know why, but after a while then he didn't mix it up. Like most players now front load the early part of the week, and then, I mean, Friday you'll do like 1500 metres, you know, it's just a walkthrough type of stuff because you want to kind of conserve it for it. So there will be reasons, and every time a team is flat they will go back over the data. I mean, in clubs like Spurs they will have 10, 15, 20 analysts that will monitor all this stuff and will try and figure out why can they marry up, why we played well, why we didn't play well, and these are all things that go on behind the scenes.
At Spurs, presumably that information is filtering its way back to Daniel Levy as well. At some point, he's going, OK, come in and explain to me exactly why all these players who were sensational over the last couple of years...
You haven't paid them.
Well, like...
I think that's what Pochettino has probably said to him. We've promised them the world for the last 2 years. They've delivered on their end, so can you deliver on your end, please? And like I said to you earlier, Pochettino will be on the side of the players because he does. He's a player's manager.
If we had a virtual million quid, would you be back in Pochettino still to be there at the start of next season?
I think Man United just go and get him. I know Roy Keane said the other night about just go and get Harry Kane. That's not as simple as that. You can't just, you know, I mean, that is a very, very oversimplistic view, because if Man United can't afford Harry Kane right now, because I'm pretty sure Danny Levy would say, well, it's going to cost 250 million quid. That's way out of it. But I think they could go and get Pochettino. And I think if Man United are to solve any of their problems, just get rid of Solskjaer and go and get him, man.
On Virgin Media last night, on Virgin Media Sport, Graeme Souness was talking about whether or not Spurs can meet Harry Kane's expectations. Have a listen to this.
Harry Kane will be saying to himself, they've not gone out, we get to the final of the Champions League last year, we've not gone forward. We've not stood still. On current form, we've gone backwards, alarmingly. So when you're at Harry Kane's age, what would Harry be now, 25, 26?
26.
Captain of England. He has to start winning stuff. You know, 26, you want to be end of each season, you know, lifting something above your head. That doesn't look like happening at Spurs. Now, as much as he'll love Spurs, because he's come through the system there, he'll want to win things. And staying at Spurs, I think, is at 2 trophies in 27 years or something. Spurs, that's just not good enough. Okay, you're playing in a shiny new stadium, which is arguably the best around at this time. But what will be important to Harry right now, and he is a prized asset, Dele Alli had stood still for 2 years. I know you had a good game at the weekend and better tonight. He stood still for 2 years. So he is a prized asset, and he's the one that people will come sniffing around. You know, you're thinking Benzema coming to his end at Real Madrid. Man United desperately needs someone.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think Barca won't be there at the end of the season, but I think those other two
people
big
will
guys,
be looking
yeah.
for him again.
Yeah, Virgin Media Sport has over 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season. It's available to all Virgin Media TV customers. You can also download the TV Anywhere app. Check out the hashtag WeFreeSport for more. Harry Kane's not going to want to stay if Pochettino's leaving.
Listen, just to reiterate what I just said, Harry Kane's signed a 5 or 6 year deal recently. He is going nowhere.
Right.
Unless someone comes in, and I mean, Harry Kane can kick down as many doors as he wants, and he, you know, Daniel Levy has set the precedent, and he'll say, well, look at the others. they all sell their contracts, so you're staying.
Right.
I mean, unless someone comes in and offers 250 million, which a Real Madrid possibly could, but I'm not sure Harry Kane is worth that. Whatever you get Harry Kane for, you are paying a hugely overinflated price. Hugely.
So not worth it for whoever signs him?
Not in a million years, no, because no, Daniel Levy is going to sell him at market value. He's his prized asset. Why would he? He's going to build a club around him. So Harry Kane will probably, as captain, be backing Pochettino, saying, can we please try and go win a league, please? So can we go and spend 250 million quid? Which is what they need, I think.
Yeah. If Man United did get Pochettino, is he the type to go out and spend massive money, or is he the type who will be able to get players and bring them through? So Christian Eriksen comes from Ajax and under Pochettino blossoms into one of the best players in his position. Maybe a bit overrated, but certainly very good. Pochettino's track record is actually for developing good players who aren't at the top of the market.
Exactly, and I think it'll be both. I think the current squad that United have is definitely underperforming. You have got some good young talent there. You've got some young, interesting players that are kind of on the cusp of becoming world class, or on the cusp of becoming like 100 million. I mean, the potential is there. That's why United signed them. You just need a manager to develop them, and Pochettino's the man for that. And not only would I go and get Pochettino, I'd go to Ajax and I'd go and get Edwin van der Sar. And I would just say, you're my team. You two, please go and fix that. And I'm going back in my office to worry about pre-tax profits.
Did you not read the bit last week where he was saying we don't make any decisions? It's was it nonsensical or insulting? Edward Ward did his first piece in a long time. It's insulting to the great football people at the club to suggest that we're making any of the decisions. He was like, they bring us their ideas, and then effectively he was saying they are still the ultimate decision makers. It was a weird piece. That's crazy.
That's absolutely crazy. I mean, ultimately, like, you know, he's the decision, because he's the one that okays the deals. He's the one that get him over the line. You know, I'm pretty sure that Mourinho went to him and said, I need a left back, can you please get me, and they give him three targets. I would be surprised if Edward would came back with a different one. He goes, he wasn't even on the list. And Edward, no, but everyone told me he was a really good left back. And he's like, yeah, we didn't fit in what I'm trying to do. That probably looks at what's going on, because sometimes the manager is going, okay, he is a good left back, but he doesn't fit what I'm trying to do. He's not where I'm trying to take this team.
There was also a bit where they'd brought a target too late to Woodward. It's like, if it's like after a transfer deadline day, it's too late. Otherwise, it's never too late to actually go and sign somebody. I don't think that's going to happen to Man United. I think Woodward still thinks he's the man for the job and still thinks he's doing a great job and still making loads of money for the Glazers. I think he's doing a great job. And so all that's important is they're making loads of money.
Yeah, that's fine. That's a business model. They're the owners of the club. They're going to do that. And the Glazers are happy when, you know, those results get released every now and again about how much money they've made, and they're still the second or first richest club in the world or whatever it is. And it's not going to change. But I'm saying, if Man United want to be a force again, because listen, one thing you can't label, you know, they've spent money. Like, they have spent massive, you know what I mean? They're upwards of nearly a billion. Is it just short of it, or not a million miles behind Man City? So they do spend the money.
Just really badly.
Just kind of in an inconsistent way. They're going to like this player, and then you end up with a mishmash and five different styles, and none of the players look like they're going to marry up. So what I'm saying is, if you want to get Pochettino and Van der Sar, they can get on the same page, and hopefully it'll get them where they want to be.
Like, there is that great kind of story of Manchester City perhaps was losing a game two seasons ago, and it was at that moment when Pep Guardiola realised that Rodri was the specific person that they needed, and that's the forward planning.
Exactly.
Like, you've just spoken there how they're trying to predict a hamstring injury.
Yeah.
Surely Manchester United should be predicting which players they should be signing in one or two seasons.
I think they are, but I mean, the process with that goes is, you know, the manager will sit down with the owner and say, you know, what are we looking for? I need a left back, I need a left midfield player. Okay, these are the three that I would like. This is the first target. If you can't get him, we'll probably go to him. And then, you know, we'll reassess that as we go. And then it looks like Woodward came back with just any left back, you know, because some agent or some other owner told him that he's the best, he's going to be the best left back or right winger or whatever it might be. And then Jose's sitting there going, okay, you give me a right winger and he's brilliant, and we did spend 60 million quid on him, but he wasn't even on the list that I gave you. That's from the outside. That's just a guess, but that's what it looks like is going on, you know, that they are delivering, but they're not delivering consistent...
strategic.
Yeah, where, you know, one Rodri to replace Fernandinho. You can see the link there, you know. Whereas Man United have chopped and changed different style of players, and then for them to spend the amount of the money they spent, then you look at their team sheet at the minute, oh my God, it's like, it's pretty thin, huh? A lot has gone in, but an awful lot has gone out as well.
Yeah, and they still are always trying to claw back the whole, and it goes back to the start of our conversation about the Spurs situation, where Alexis Sanchez is making so much money compared to everybody else in the squad that everybody gets annoyed by the fact that
without doubt.
He's actually not earning the money he's getting paid in a way that everybody else is.
Right.
And I don't think he can come back from that until that whole group of players are gone.
Mm. Well, if you start paying players type money to pay Sanchez, and you're another type of player who's carrying the team, being the main man, you're entitled to go and knock on the door of the owner and say, "Wait, you've moved the pay structure. I haven't. Yeah. You've kind of pushed the bar here. I'm, you know, your best player. Your manager's saying every week in the paper how I'm, you know, so important to the team. The whole everything that goes with it. So I need to be bumped up, please." And then you get caught in a slippery slope, and you just gets out of hand then after a while, and then the player, the change room, gets upset, and everybody's going, "Well, hang on a minute, he gets this, why am I not getting this? He doesn't even come in anymore." It's like strange.
Can the club recover quickly from that though?
Yeah, but they need to start at the top. And first and foremost, Edward Ed just needs to go away into his office and put football people in charge of football and decisions. And I think Pochettino and Van der Sar just looks like a perfect team. You know, Van der Sar would have the scouting network in place around Europe. So
they both kind of, Van der Sar, it seemed, could have had that job. Certainly, you know, he's not going to come out and say, "I want the job," until he has the job, because otherwise, you know, you put yourself in a bad negotiating position. But they've been talking about trying to get a director of football. He's obviously the CEO at Ajax. Why has it not just happened?
Because Man United are probably still making money and they don't see a problem with it. The Glazers are probably going, "Well, we're trying," but Ed Woodward, maybe, I don't know the guy. I mean, it was a very interesting clip. Remember at West Ham where Phil Jones was sat behind Woodward and he said something like "sacked" in the morning, and he turned around like with no authority. I mean, for a player to say that with an owner sat in front of you and to say it loud enough for him to hear you, the lack of respect. I mean, that'll just tell you, it gives you a little insight that maybe he doesn't have any authority over anything and he's just floating through the world. I saw that and I just was like, I put my head down and went, "Oh my God, you're going to be absolutely torn asunder." But the way he turned around and was like, would he say something like, "We're on camera" or something? He was going, "Oh my God." But for a player to even feel free to say that loud enough, knowing the owner sat in front of him, just shows the type of boss that he is, that they don't have any respect for him.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's play this clip here. It's another clip from Desi Hutchinson's interview last night. This is great stuff. Have a look at it.
Did you just kind of lose the love of soccer then?
A small bit. It's different when you come home because the standards are so different. The lifestyle is really different. So it was that, and things were a bit uncertain at Waterford at the time, so I didn't really know where I stood with it. I wasn't playing as much as I wanted to. There was loads of little things that kind of added up that I said, "Look, I need a career change. I'm not going to leave it till I'm 28, 29. No disrespect to leave Ireland or anything, but you're not going to make enough money or whatever it is to last you when you're finished. So for me, it was about hopefully getting back into education as early as possible rather than being 28, 29 and then having to go back.
The standards thing is an interesting one because it's something I've heard before from other sources, from people who've come home and have joined League of Ireland clubs, is that they're so used to the framework that's in place in the club they're with over in the UK that when they come home to a slightly less organised situation that they can find it hard to deal with, and they find it hard to, I guess, trying to get their head around maybe the attitudes of some of the players. I'm not saying that they're, you know, slack in attitude, but it's just a very different environment to the one you've just left.
Yeah, it is, and that's the biggest thing. Like no matter what, the League of Ireland is never going to compare to the Premier League because of the amount of money that's involved in it, the facilities clubs have, the amount of staff the clubs have. Just everything is just on a different height over there.
Yeah, I guess that's re-echoing the point that we were making a little bit earlier on about that and just how difficult it is to get people to fall back in love with the games. The one thing that struck me watching that was, though, in terms of educating our young footballers, and particularly the ones who go away, to get an education in the background so that you don't feel like you need to leave League of Ireland. You could come back and do part-time League of Ireland and have a career outside of it. You know, you made it as a footballer. If you didn't make it as a footballer, did you have something to fall back on? Was that always part of your thinking, or did you actually think?
Absolutely not. I had absolutely nothing to fall back on.
Right.
I it was all or nothing for me, to be honest. Yeah, I was going to figure out the other part if it didn't work as I went, and I'm still figuring out after I just finished now anyway. So I don't believe in putting safety things in place in anything. I think if you're going to do something, go and do it properly, and if it doesn't work out, then pick up the pieces and devise another plan and go again.
Okay, that's
that's not probably advice you should be giving out, to be honest with you. That's not great advice, Daddy. Yeah, get an education, put something in place, that's great. But I always think that, you know, if you're going to be a footballer, you've got to be 100% into it. If you're going to split 20% doing an education, it means you're already, and I think that's a funny mindset to go down where you've already put in a plan in place for failure. But look, Desi did it the right way around. He went over, didn't work out for him, came home, then realised he was done with football, and then he went to his education. I think that's, you know, perfectly acceptable.
All right,
thing to do.
It's 8:40 a.m. this morning. You're watching OTB AM, the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. Damien's going to stick with us, but up next we're crossing back to Japan to chat to former England rugby centre Mike Tindall. First, here's Eddie Jones speaking yesterday.
There's definitely someone in the apartment block filming, but it might have been a Japanese fan.
You didn't send anyone to go?
No, we don't care, mate. Don't care.
Sorry, you just said that everyone does that. Would you film their
yacht? Yeah, we've got someone there now, mate. We've got someone there now.
You answer that question seriously. Would you film another team?
I haven't done it since 2000 and... I better get the numbers right here. 2001, we used to do it.
And do you think it's sort of ethically wrong to do that?
Look, you just don't need to do it anymore, mate, because you see everything. Yeah, you can watch everyone's training on YouTube or whatever there is. There's everything out there. There's no value in doing that sort of thing now. Absolutely zero.
Yeah, so there's just a little bit of telecommunications issues with the line to Mike Tindall. We'll get to him in just a minute. Filming of training sessions, is it that big a deal? Eddie Jones says he did it in 2001. You don't need to do it anymore because you've got all the video evidence anyway. Marcello Bielsa obviously disagrees.
I think the only thing to be gained for it is to see who's training, who's not training.
Right.
So you can maybe get an idea of who's fit and who's not fit. But he's right in what he said there. You know, nobody's reinventing the wheel. Everybody knows what they're going to do. No one's going to like come up with a mad game plan. So just getting an idea of numbers really is
And even is it that much of a benefit? Because the team gets named an hour beforehand, and you know, unless there like is like a guy from the
right.
third team or the 19-year-olds.
I agree with you. It makes no difference.
Is it all mind games?
I think it's something Eddie Jones is doing. He's talked a lot this week. I think he's just taking the sting out of it for his players. So all the headlines are about these funny little things, and we're talking about this. And his players are free to go under the radar and stay focused. You know.
Yeah. Do mind games work?
No, but he's helping his players. He doesn't care about New Zealand. He's just definitely helping his players there and taking the heat off his players by coming out with outrageous statements.
Were you ever in that situation where you had a manager in the build-up to a game trying to take pressure off you? Or like, are you aware of it even happening? Are you talking about it in the dressing room?
No.
So
if the manager comes out and says daft things, the players will laugh, like, you know what I mean? Sometimes the manager will laugh as well, but it's just one thing he doesn't need. Everyone knows he's doing it, and that's exactly where he's going with it. He's that's all he's doing there.
Yeah, okay. So
I'd have thought.
Largely irrelevant.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically, so we're talking about this instead of his players or whatever.
Start.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Ajax against Chelsea, Genk against Liverpool and Inter against Dortmund are the big fixtures in tonight's Champions League. Ajax are predicted to win that game by the Racing Post. Are they as good as they showed last season, or was actually... what happened last season, one of those weird European aberrations?
I think they're a very good side. I'm really interested in this game, just from a Chelsea point of view, because it's going to be a good yardstick for them, where it's the first, I won't say real test. I know they've played Liverpool and United, but they're not going to see a lot of the ball tonight. You know, you watch the game against Newcastle and Jorginho's having his say and he's dictating everything. It's going to be interesting for them when they don't have the ball tonight, defensively, how good they are, how structured they are, how disciplined they are. There's going to be a lot of interesting... I can't wait to watch this game, actually. It's probably the most excited I've been for a football game in a long time.
Right.
Because Lampard, obviously, is evolving and things are going along and things are going great for them, or people are positive or whatever. I think tonight they're really going to be under pressure from a tactical point of view.
What do you expect from Chelsea this season, then? Like, continued improvement the whole way, is that good enough?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it depends on this transfer ban, possibility of it being overturned in January, maybe not, I don't know. That's what will get Lampard through the season, is because he's got enough things to say, well, look, I'm doing my best. And he is doing good. I mean, he's doing okay. But, you know, once the transfer ban is lifted, who's signing players? Is Lampard signing them? Is he being handed players? Whereas right now, he can kind of create this siege mentality of, like, you're my guys, that's it, I'm working with you guys. No one's coming in January, probably not even next summer, possibly. So he's free to develop players, and these players that are developing are free to make mistakes because they'll play again next week, you know?
In a weird way, it's not a bad situation. Like, they've invested so much in young players over the last 5 or 6 years, over the last decade, really. They've got, you know, they've had 40 players on loan at various stages. So if you wanted a dream scenario to be a young manager, the pressure is off and you have to work with these players. You have to, like, it's perfect.
It's a really good strategic decision by Chelsea insofar as putting the club legend in charge. He's going to get a free pass from the fans.
If he's any good, it's brilliant.
Well, he's going to get free pass, number one, because they're under the transfer ban. Number two, he's Frank Lampard. And number three, they're developing young players. And everyone at every club wants to see young players developed. And they've been forced into this situation. So I think it was a really, really good, strategic, well thought out decision for them. Obviously, next year when they do sign players, if he can have developed all these guys for resale value, so if they do want to go and spend money, they can almost, you know, not spend too much because they can offset it with some sales.
Yeah.
It's an interesting mindset, isn't it? The fact that your kind of position in the squad to a certain point isn't under a whole pile of threat with the looming transfer window. I mean, that surely gives people a kick up the hole when it's required.
Yeah.
But maybe in this situation, it's not the case. Maybe there's just enough youthful exuberance in the squad that is what drives it on.
Yeah, and I think Lampard's kind of tapping into that, and he definitely has them all. Definitely has them all on the same page, really, and everyone seems pretty buoyant. They've had some good results, some good performances. But I think tonight's going to be the first time they're really going to be tested tactically, and Lampard's going to be tested as a coach, you know, to how well prepared they are for Ajax to be dominating the ball. I expect Ajax to have 60% plus possession tonight.
Liverpool have had some random, weird results away from home in the Champions League over the last couple of seasons. Is there a possibility against Genk tonight that they have another one?
Would have thought not, no. I think Genk or, you know, Liverpool could probably make a couple of changes tonight and still come out on top relatively comfortably.
Yeah, fair enough. Alright, Damien, we're going to let you go. Thanks a million. It's 8:47 a.m. this morning. New Zealand's Herald's Gregor Paul is going to join us on the line in just a minute for a bit of gloating over the fact that they hammered us this weekend. In the meantime,
I met him in the press box actually the other day, and he was totally fine. He wasn't gloating at all. He kind of wanted him to gloat, but he didn't do so.
Yeah, okay. Actually, we've got Gregor on the line. Gregor, good morning to you. How are you
gracious.
Doing? I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good. I can't believe you didn't gloat. This was your one opportunity. One opportunity. You've many opportunities to gloat.
Yeah, nah, no need for gloating. I was actually a wee bit disappointed in the end. I don't think Ireland really did themselves justice out there and made it, you know, and worked the All Blacks anywhere near hard enough for any gloating to be done. It felt like they didn't really turn up. So there's a wee bit of disappointment about that.
Yeah. So the debate here is whether or not the Irish handling errors were caused by the pressure that New Zealand were putting them under, or if we just played really, really badly as well as some of the pressure.
Probably a combination of the two. I would have thought that the All Blacks defended particularly well. I think they only missed one tackle in the first half, and the line speed was good. They were aggressive. They put Ireland under a lot of pressure. I got the feeling, though, that Ireland came into the game feeling a little bit of pressure. And that certainly was my impression afterwards as well, was that they, you know, having beaten the All Blacks back in November, it felt like they really challenged themselves to make sure they made the semi-final. And that seemed to be, from what they were saying, became a bit of an issue for them. They became almost obsessed with it. And it looked a wee bit like that. It looked a wee bit like they were never really at that game, that they were nervous, that they were mistake-ridden from the start. The All Blacks were good, put them under yet more pressure, and it just compounded all the errors for them. And but I think when the All Blacks get ahead early, as they did, they're a difficult team to rein back in.
Yeah, we aren't very good at coming back from behind. So as soon as the first try went over, It was a real uh-oh. Unless we score next, it's not going to happen. Like, in a weird way, Richie Mwanga kills the game by preventing Johnny Sexton's penalty from going out. Once that happened, and ultimately they score a try almost immediately afterwards by going the length of the field, that was ball game from Ireland's perspective. I don't feel like New Zealand ever felt any threat or any danger. As soon as Jacob Stockdale has the knock on and the penalty gets scored and there's a lead, New Zealand are like, OK, well, there's no rustiness after our two-week break, and there's no rustiness from the fact that we haven't really played a meaningful game in the space of over a month against the Springboks.
Yeah. And I don't think there was going to be any rustiness. It probably wasn't all that helpful that they didn't play against Italy. But look, they're professional guys. I mean, they've been playing Super Rugby since, you know, end of January. So there's plenty of rugby in the system. I didn't really ever think that would become a factor in the game. But I think they always knew that to play Ireland effectively, the last couple of times, certainly when they played in Chicago, Ireland were miles ahead at one point. I can't remember what the score was, but it was a long, long, long way ahead. And they're aware that if you let Ireland get ahead, they're a very suffocating team when they're at their best. They don't give you the ball, they hold on to it, and they make life really difficult for you if they control the scoreboard like that. So I think what we saw was an All Black team that had worked out that the best chance to kill Ireland's big threat was they had to hit them hard early, they had to turn up with the right attitude, they had to really blitz Ireland from minute one and take them on. And I think we saw that reflection, and they knew the importance of scoring tries early and getting that early lead. So there was no doubt that was a very deliberate play on New Zealand's part to be that focused and that deliberate in those first 20 minutes or so.
Where does the legacy of Joe Schmidt from a New Zealand standpoint now rest, Gregor?
I mean, I think he's done a fantastic job. I mean, it's never ideal when your last game is one like that, and A, it's a poor performance, and B, it's a failure to deliver the one thing that your legacy hasn't quite come up with, and Irish rugby was so desperate to see. So there'll probably be a lot of hurt, and a lot of people will be unsure right now about what to make of that. But from a New Zealand perspective, they did something twice. Be the All Blacks that they hadn't done in whatever it was, 111 years, and they managed to do it twice under Joe. And I think probably beyond that, they've become a consistently good team, not last weekend's events withstanding, obviously, but they've been ranked number one in the world, albeit briefly. They've been in the top three really for much of Joe's tenure in charge, I believe. They've played fairly effective rugby. They've won Six Nations. They've become a genuine foe for the All Blacks. I mean, probably the last 4 or 5 years, New Zealand would put Ireland right up there with South Africa, in terms of the team that's caused them issues. And we take Ireland way more seriously. Now, I don't mean that disrespectfully, but when New Zealand never lost, then you get into that habit of believing that they never will. And I think that's maybe the biggest thing, that Joe has turned that team around to make them realise that they're more than just capable of competing for 65 minutes against New Zealand. They're capable of beating them. And I suspect there's probably a whole generation of Irish kids now who come through believing and knowing that Ireland are capable of beating New Zealand. So, I mean, that's probably something that Joe will take away, and that will be his legacy, I suppose. He's put the All Blacks on Ireland's radar as a team that they're capable of beating.
Somebody made the point the other day that when Graham Henry and Steve Hansen left Wales, they didn't leave either of those two teams as World Cup winners or as a dominant force in world rugby. And yet it was still possible for them both at some point in the future to go to New Zealand and ultimately end up with the All Blacks gig. So the game at the weekend doesn't prevent Joe Schmidt from, at some point down the line, taking a Super Rugby job and ultimately getting himself back into the reckoning for the New Zealand gig, does it?
No, of course not. Look, I mean, it wouldn't be fair on any coach to judge them by one game, as disappointing as it was for Ireland. Like, he's had, whatever it is, 5-6 years of consistent performance. He was a genuine contender if he'd been willing to put himself forward for that, for the All Black job at the end of this year. He would absolutely be one of the contenders, and I would have thought that probably he might even have got it. And I don't think that will change just because New Zealand beat Ireland in a quarter final in 2019. I mean, what will matter next for Joe is what does he do? Where is he going to go? Is he, how long is he going to be in hiatus? Is he going to come back to New Zealand and sort of be visible? Because that would be important, I think, from an All Black perspective. Even if he's not coaching, to have him back in the country might be important. How long does he not coach for? What's his next move in terms of a coaching gig? Who are the All Blacks going to appoint at the end of this year and for how long? And how successful that might be will have a bearing on what sort of time period you'd be looking at before they look for another appointment. But, look, if Joe comes back and he wants to get involved in Super Rugby and there's an opportunity to do that, every Super Rugby team would snap him up. And presumably he'll be quite successful at that because I just imagine that's who he is. And if he does that and he's interested in coaching the All Blacks, he would, in time, absolutely, he'd be a guy that they would absolutely take.
Yeah. OK, there's two other quick things I want to talk about. Steve Hansen in the aftermath of the game talked about, we kept being reminded that Ireland had beaten us twice. I guess that's the reason why you were saying that Ireland are taken seriously as an opponent now, because it got spoken about a lot here that Ireland had beaten New Zealand twice, but it seems like it got spoken about quite a lot in New Zealand that Ireland had beaten them twice, and so this game was on the radar. There was no chance of New Zealand in any way underestimating or coming out and kind of going, ah, look, it's only Ireland, should we always beat them?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was probably the most helpful thing that Joe Schmidt did and Ireland did for New Zealand was beat them in November. Because a one-off in Chicago, you could kind of put it down to a bad day or whatever, but to do it twice in the last three outings made sure that nobody thought Ireland had just got lucky. It very much made Ireland a team. I mean, there was a high degree of nervousness in New Zealand, I believe, about playing that game. I mean, I think everybody could see that maybe Ireland had come off the level that they were at in November, but there was still a feeling that they might, if they could reach the sort of level of intensity that they put in November, and if they could get into the game early, that they were absolutely capable of winning that. So, yeah, you're right. There was no way, and it was the World Cup quarterfinals. You knew at this point if the All Blacks turned up and they weren't in the right mindset anyway. But it was a double whammy. There's no doubt about that. It was World Cup quarterfinal. And it's against Ireland, a team who had beaten New Zealand twice in the last three encounters. And there was no way in the world were they going to underestimate the Irish and let them make it three out of four.
Yeah. Was there much disdain in New Zealand for the Irish fans singing during the haka?
No. People can do. I'm not a New Zealander, so I don't feel anything around the haka. But look, people, New Zealand are privileged in that they're allowed to perform the haka before the game. And look, my view is it is a great theatre. Like, whether it's an advantage, disadvantage, right, wrong, I don't particularly care. I think fans pay money and they love watching it. And certainly the Japanese fans really, really love watching it. And I think probably most players enjoy facing it. It's something a bit different. It creates a little bit of, tradition around rugby. But teams should be allowed to face it however they like. I don't even think that World Rugby should make them stand 10 metres back. They want to get right up into the All Black space. I think they should be allowed to do that. And fans, if they want to sing, go for it. Well, it's not, there's no kind of right or wrong way. And it's certainly not culturally offensive for Irish fans to have a bit of a sing-song if they don't want to hear the haka. So, no one. I mean, some media outlets will try and get some clickbait headlines around it, but no one really minds that kind of stuff. It's
yeah.
Part of the entertainment package.
Well, it was a unique World Cup moment. Unfortunately, the rest of the game, from our perspective, certainly didn't live up to the pre-match entertainment. And then, Gregor, you should know that you've been picked up by all of the Irish websites for referring to the Ireland team as a team of limited old cart horses who never stood a chance. And the thing is, Gregor, if you'd said this 18 months ago, we'd have had you on here and we'd have been going, oh, hang on a second. But we don't really have much of a leg to stand on, unfortunately.
Oh, look, I didn't mean to be quite that harsh here at the moment when you're filing under a deadline. But look, I've got to be honest, by the end of the game, there was a few of the Irish players who looked to me like they'd been hanging on for 12 months too long in that team. And the pace of the game was too much for them. The skill level of New Zealand was too much for them. And I think that's something that Ireland will probably be spending a little bit of time looking at and thinking about is how do they close that gap?
And isn't that precisely the difference between Steve Hansen and Joe Schmidt, though? Because pre-World Cup, Steve Hansen looked at his squad and anybody who he thought was hanging on or not going to be able for the intensity and pace of the World Cup in Japan, he cut and he put a bunch of kids in. And that was his point about experience. Ireland, full of experience, full of the experience of losing World Cup quarterfinals. New Zealand, players full of the experience of winning.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a wee bit of a surprise for us that, you know, on the kind of on the eve of a World Cup, really, that you see Ben Smith come out of the team. Sonny Bill Williams couldn't get himself back into the team. There'd be others off the top of my head, can't actually think of them. Ryan Clottie not able to get back into the team either. So they took out a whole. They were brave enough to take out a whole series of old experienced players who weren't actually playing that badly either, but they just had a feeling that your likes of George Bridge, Jack Gucci, Sevu Reese, that they were the guys for the now. They were young, they were full of energy, and they could play in that revamped attacking style that the All Blacks knew that they had to come back to the World Cup with if they were going to break down all these defences. And you know, they also persuaded Barrett Bowden to give up his number 10 jersey and go and play at fullback, which, again, a lot of people thought that's mad. You're taking the world, you know, one of the world's best fly halves and making him play at fullback. Is that nuts? Might have been, but, you know, they've made it all work and they've made that game plan work for them. They've taken risks, they've evolved, they've advanced. They were a completely different team to the one that they were in November. And then you look at Ireland and you go, well, where did they change? It looked like largely the same personnel, give or take injuries. Game plan was very much the same, built around one defensive plan, and a lot of box kicking. And, you know, in the end, they just didn't push on hard enough in those 12 months since they beat the All Blacks, and the All Blacks did. And we saw them beat them in November and then lose by 30 points at the World Cup. Yeah. And I think that probably is a proof that you need that they didn't move on.
Well, like, I wonder, Gregor, if a very similar game had broken out in Dublin last November, but the results would have been different had the All Blacks won, would we have seen a vastly different situation this year? I don't think we might have, because I think New Zealand have been used to the process of actually identifying what might be going wrong, not getting carried away with the result and actually planning accordingly. Like, I mean, maybe if Ireland had lost that game, maybe it sends a few more alarm bells ringing, but really, I'm not sure it would have, to be honest. Like, I think perhaps it was the performance that night, it was perhaps actual identification that people were slowing down and that they did need, whatever it was, 8 personnel changes in the starting 15, 11 months later, that the result wasn't what mattered. It was actually what the coaches had identified from previous experiences and from previous failures in the All Blacks. And I think that is the big lesson for Ireland now, is that New Zealand have been a country that have learned vastly from the failings, especially when it comes to 2007. And Ireland now need to make 2019 their Irish version of the All Blacks 07.
Yep. Look, I think you're probably right. I think, to be honest, so the All Blacks were probably looking, they were trying to evolve the game before that match in November last year. They were kind of aware, Ireland didn't kind of open their eyes to something. Ireland opened their eyes to how severe the problem was rather than pointing out that there was a problem. And the All Blacks knew they were struggling to play the attack game that they had in mind, and they knew that they had to evolve it back in November anyway. They just weren't very far down the track at that point. But I think that is the key thing, is that the All Blacks never stop thinking about, you know, what's next. I mean, they have this whole saying of, you know, if you're standing still, you're going backwards. So they're constantly looking, constantly evolving what they're trying to do, so that, you know, the trends of the game are being led by them, so they don't get caught out, you know, with a game plan that's maybe 6 months too old because everyone else has worked it out and they haven't caught up. And you know, I don't know, Ireland went through a whole World Cup cycle pretty effectively, winning a lot of games with a particular style of rugby, and maybe they were just caught out in the end that they didn't realise that come the World Cup, a lot of other teams, particularly New Zealand, would be looking a bit different at that stage because they keep evolving. And that's probably, you're right, that's definitely the lesson for Ireland, is you've got to try and predict into the future and see what's going to happen.
Speaking of that, what do you think is going to happen this weekend?
Sabres, don't know. Super tight. England looked good. Admittedly, they were helped along the way by Australia. But it's certainly a good team. They've certainly got the capabilities of winning. Don't know. I think it might be very tight, maybe 2, 3, 4 points in it. You'd probably back New Zealand because of the world number one, but wouldn't be surprised if England win. And bizarrely, I think Wales are going to pick themselves up because they've been pretty poor at the World Cup. And I think they've probably got one big game in them, and I think they might deliver it. So I'm picking New Zealand and Wales.
OK, that'll be a great semi-final outcome, and certainly it sounds like they're going to be good games. Gregor, great to have you with us this morning. Thanks a million. Enjoy it.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye.
It's Gregor Paul there giving us some thoughts.
I wonder when was the precise moment that Joe Schmidt knew this wasn't going to happen. Like, I do...
Do you mean did it happen at the England game in Dublin?
Exactly.
In February? Or did it happen in the middle of the Scotland game where he's like, oh, this isn't actually as good as we think it is? Or did it happen in the Japan game? Or did it happen when the knock-on happens and they got 3-0 down?
I think it might have happened when he's actually sitting down to select the squad and Devon Toner's not in it. And he's like, oh my God, this guy was one of our best players 10 months ago. Last year when we beat the All Blacks, Devon Toner was absolutely vital. He can't even make my squad. Look at this fall.
But
look
at this. We didn't lose because the set piece. Our set piece was really good.
But what I'm saying is that's indicative of perhaps a wider malaise. Like, I wonder, did he say, oh my God, there is like a downfall here. There's been kind of a Toner-esque lack in form from...
But Toner was injured,
perhaps,
right?
Perhaps Murray. Granted. But Murray was injured, and we didn't need Murray to beat the All Blacks, which is the counterpoint to that. But there were just a number of different areas where you're like, there can be that precipitous decline in the space of a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
After that height, it's very, very hard to identify who is about to fall off, like who is about to go off that cliff. And maybe when he identified, like as a top-class coach, this guy is not good enough to have on the plane. Never mind the starting team, he's not good enough to have on the plane to Japan. Maybe at that moment he realised that we were in a spot of bother here.
Well,
I'd like to think he realised it beforehand.
Like John Klein, I think part of the kerfuffle over John Klein was that he wasn't...
But it's nothing to do with John Klein. It's the, like my point is just on Toner alone. And I'm talking about
connected,
like, the drop-off. Like, granted, he would have identified John Klein as, at that moment, a better...
But not actually good enough to get in the team. Or not good enough to have an impact in the World Cup quarterfinal.
Yeah,
so
well, that's
basically
true.
A passenger, basically a body... A camp body to use for the match where you're resting players for the big game. So not really putting anybody under any threat, not driving the competition forward in training.
Yeah,
like only as strong as the weakest part of it. And whereas Toner would have been somebody who you think if he gets fit he's going to start, but they obviously felt like he wasn't going to be able to get up to match fitness over that whole time. But they, Robbie Henshaw was able to get back into their thinking. Maybe they thought they couldn't win without Robbie Henshaw. Was Chris Farrell not fit? Did he not recover in time for the last game? Was he not in consideration? He looked fit. He was out doing training. He came off. They all did a full warm-up before the game and they all came off absolutely shattered. I felt like if he's fit, he's playing well enough versus Robbie Henshaw hasn't played himself back into form just yet.
Yeah, like I think Chris Farrell is always an easy option to talk about when... You know, you aren't getting past the game line and stuff like that because he's just such a big guy, and it's like that could do with a bit of a Chris Farrell. And I think he's fantastic, he's been brilliant every time he's thrown on the green jersey, but I do think there's a clear hierarchy there as well. Like, he obviously did pick up a couple of knocks during the World Cup as well, though. And like, Schmidt hasn't actually specified what exactly the niggles were that week. Like, he's spoken about it now that there were niggles in the week leading up to it, whereas the information we were getting that there's 30 fully fit players and that Bundiaki suspended.
Got to do what New Zealand did and have that whole full get everybody in, listen to what they have to say, have the examination about the mental issues that we have created in Irish rugby over the last however many years it's really been. Like,
what do you mean by mental issues?
Our inability to focus on anything except a World Cup quarterfinal ever in Irish rugby. It's like, it's a holy grail, and it's a stupid holy grail because it's not a World Cup final or a semi-final. And we've talked ourselves into this. Joe Schmidt says now, it's like, oh, we talked ourselves into this self-consuming monster.
Well, like, I mean, there were other areas of that as well. We talked ourselves into never beating the All Blacks because they were always going to beat us. After 2013, that dream was as far away as ever. They will always beat us. We managed to turn that around. Like, winning the Grand Slam on an even number year was something that we were like, we might win it in 09 because... You know, we got to finish up in Cardiff, but we got the English and the French at home. We'll never be able to do that on the road, and perhaps that became a thing. Now, I'm not saying that it's on the level of the quarterfinal, because the quarterfinal has now become this massive thing, which is beyond everything else. But there were a number of other barriers that were knocked down. Like, provincial rugby this time 4 years ago was in a crap place. Like, we were talking about how on earth is Ireland ever going to get back to that. And then last year, in the last two seasons, Leinster have lost one knockout game. Like, I mean, that is the hallmark of a team and a group of players who actually know how to win, who know how to play knockout rugby. And I'm not sure if, like, the nerves or the edge is that much increased for a World Cup quarterfinal as it is for, say, a Champions Cup final. Of course, it's bigger. It's a bigger event, in my opinion.
But still,
you're pretty nervous. Like, I'd say that day in Bilbao before the
Racing
game.
I don't think it's about the day in Bilbao. I think it's about the full... All we care about in Irish rugby is now getting through a quarterfinal. And
sure,
I think
yeah.
4 years of... Like, if Ireland won every Grand Slam between now and 2023 and Leinster, Munster, Ulster and Connacht all won a Heineken Cup in the interim period, we would still be absolutely saying nothing matters except this World Cup quarterfinal. And if we got
true.
The All Blacks again, and it was like an All Blacks team who are the best All Blacks team of all time, and we lose, we'd be like, oh, Irish rugby is broken. It needs fixed.
Mm.
Like...
But the problem is you get absolutely trounced coming off the back of being the world number one team. That's where the issue is.
It's 10 minutes past nine this morning here on OTB AM. Let's have a look at this. We've been shooting a brilliant all-access behind-the-scenes documentary with Connacht Rugby for the last year. The full Grassroots to Green Shirts documentary is going to be released on OTB's social channels in the coming weeks. Here's a little taster for you.
Ball's coming from there and I'm standing here. I'm giving you that space.
Before we went to South Africa, friendly challenged us and said, if we get two wins here, we're nearly set up for the season. It puts us in a brilliant place.
You love anything to do with the hospice, knowing you make a difference to people's lives in a way like...
We've put a lot of investment in supporting facilities in other cities in recent years, and I think it's long overdue that we have a similar investment in this city.
There we go, much better, keep it going! Go!
Tried to tackle someone pretty big, unfortunately dislocated my shoulder.
Jack Carty is probably the biggest success story of all, and he comes in halfway through the Six Nations and he's got a realistic shot of making it to the World Cup.
If we're in the top six, we're in the playoff. If we're in the playoffs, all better off.
Connacht Rugby Grassroots to Green Shirts.
Yeah, Grassroots. Grassroots to Green Shirts, an OTB documentary on Connacht being released very soon across Off the Ball. The first season of The Classic, a new documentary series from Off the Ball with four incredible stories, were released earlier on this month. Owen Sheehan's Brawl was the very first one.
OTB presents The Classic, a new series of incredible sporting stories from Off the Ball.
So I went and raced from 25 metres, and the rest, as I say, is history.
One little spark in the goal mouth kicked the thing off. Then all of a sudden, it was like a forest fire. They were at it all around the place.
The spark happened, and I'm standing there, and I'm saying, right, just go in and hit as many as I can.
Started in front of goal, and that was a sequel. And that's John Casey down there. Shipped it up to the face.
And I had zero idea what was after happening. I think I could have actually got knocked out for a second or two.
I was actually about to close the headlock thing when John McDermott came in and hit me on the hip and just pushed me out of the way. So pushed me in the path of David Brady. David came in just swinging at everything, so he did.
I threw as many punches. I closed my eyes and threw as many punches as I could, whether it was me old men or me men.
It was like something you'd see outside Supermax. Fellas were in, kicking and throwing haymakers and trying to knock fellas out. And some guys did get knocked out, but it was a real fight. Like, it was...
Episode 1, this Sunday, October 13th, on News Talk.
Yeah? Good response to it?
It seems to be, yeah. Like, there was one comment on Facebook saying, this is the worst documentary I've ever heard, which was somebody from Meath, I think. It seems to go down well with Mayo people, not so much with Meath people.
No, Meath people are like, oh, I can't believe that it matters so much to them. Meath people don't understand.
No. You say I don't like Mayo. Well, this is my peace offering to Mayo people. I'm sorry.
You like the players. It's the supporters you don't like.
That's not going to get into it. Like, wait for the Allianz League and we can talk about GAA.
Okay. You know? Well, no. The documentary was good, right?
It was good. I was very happy with the Noam Brennan, who worked on it with me, did a fantastic job, especially on the sound design element and putting it all together in the end. So I basically my role is just getting out, getting the story, and chatting to all the people involved.
Were you surprised by anything?
Yes.
Did I send you the story about a recent court case where there'd been a row in a Chippers in Westport last year that had started about the brawl in 96?
Yeah. It's like, incredible.
Still fighting about it.
There were like a couple of things that definitely surprised me. One being John Casey, one of the first people I interviewed, saying, yeah, regularly still have nightmares now about this thing that happened 24 years ago, 25.
The fight or losing the game?
Everything.
Nice.
Like the specific dream is that he's standing on the turf in Croke Park, and then this big hole opens and it just swallows him up as the All-Ireland is happening above the ground, and he's so helpless to do anything about it.
He needs to get on the Dr. Melfi's couch and let her explain to him what that means.
Yeah, it's very, very true. There's no, what was it, ducks in Tony Soprano's dreams? I don't think there's any ducks in Croke Park in his dreams. Lee McHale getting anonymous letters from Dublin the week before game, before the replay, saying something bad is going to happen to you. Something bad is going to happen to you. You are going to be the fall guy or something. And obviously that was strangely prophetic. And then there's other stuff that I can't quite remember. Like David Brady just talking about doing the bossing over with Mead there in the middle of it all, and just he said that he just went in and did windmills, and that was all he did, just hit everything he could possibly could, whether they're my players or their players or whoever they were.
Alright, all this week on you can get that on the Go Loud app, and you can also get it, of course, offtheball.com/podcasts, and there's four of them. We'll tell you about the other three in the coming days as well. This week on OTBAM though, we're giving you the chance to win UEFA Champions League quarter final tickets, with thanks to Pepsi Max, one of the proud sponsors of the UEFA Champions League. Every entry this week will be entered into Friday's final draw, and then we have a daily prize of Pepsi promotional packs up for grabs on OTBAM. To be in with a chance of winning this morning, to share the show wherever you're watching and listening, and name the Irish footballers with the Champions League medal since the 1990s. They are all from a couple of clubs, and you should be able to work that one out. Just a reminder, if you don't win on OTBAM this week, then there are loads more ways to win with Pepsi Max. More than 20 tickets are up for grabs for games in the Champions League group stages. Check out pepsimax.ie for more. A few quick more comments. Welcome back from Japan, lads. It's Patrick McHugh. I was at the opening ceremony, South Africa versus the All Blacks, and Ireland against Scotland. Japan's a great place. Takes a lot out of you. No fruit. Loads of sandwiches from 7-Eleven. We should explain that 7-Eleven is like every third shop. It's like it's grown up like knotweed, and it's just everywhere.
Yeah, and like if the 7-Eleven across the road is at a intersection that you can't be bothered to cross. Just look left or right, and there's probably one on the other side. Like it's got a lot of coverage, put it that way. And yes, I agree with him on the sandwiches thing. Too many of them.
Crossing the road is a weird experience.
Why? Because you actually have to abide by the green and the red man.
Not because you have to. You don't have to, but everybody does. It's not like you're going to get shot by a sniper, although it feels like you might, because so the crossroads are quite far apart. You've got to go and find one, and then everybody sits and stops and waits for the green man. They don't just stroll across when there's no traffic.
No.
There could be no traffic for miles and miles and miles, and the light's red, you're not crossing.
No, well, like, I mean, is that not just a safe way to do it?
It is, yeah. There was one bit where it was the second day I was there, and I looked up and the light was red, but there was a green and a red, so if you weren't turning right... So it was fine. There was loads of people, and I could see it was going red. It was like the things, they give you a guidance of how soon it's going to change. So I took a couple of steps forward, and then I was like, actually, you know what, this isn't very nice. But I didn't. I looked behind me, and loads of people followed me.
You're the leader.
They've got their phones down, and they just sense movement. And sure, nobody's going to go when it's red. So when I stopped, they stopped. And then I went back and they started to laugh. It was like this, oh, look, we've accidentally crossed the road at the wrong time. But it was just this, well, now I'm freaked out.
It's like leading a yoga class. It was like, I mean, the motorists there can be aggressive enough, the taxi drivers in particular. So I think that's maybe the
genesis. I heard a horn tooted once in 5 days.
Well, that's a different thing, though. I mean,
it's silence. It's this giant city of 12 million people who are wandering around in silence.
Yeah, I took a phone call on the train once, and a man pointed to the sign, and I was like, I'm going to get off the next stop because somebody's going to kill me.
I feel sorry for Joe and those retiring, because any last game can go one of two ways. Your last game does not sum up your career. It needs to be looked at as a whole. And has a whole been superb, says Barbara Richardson. Paddy Dunn says, where's Tyndall? Busy uploading today's AB's training session for Eddie. busy celebrating the amazing putt that he had in that four ball with Brian O'Driscoll, Roy McIlroy and Tiger Woods, or at least taking the credit for it. House of Hopla, a film by Scram Films and Mark Mulholland, is a story about NBA shooting coach Dave Hopla and his time in Belfast in the early 1980s, telling the story of basketball and brotherhood that has lasted a lifetime with St. Gall's Basketball Club. The premiere is tonight, but yesterday Dave popped into studio with Kieran Donaghy for a chat about his life. Really amazing stuff that we're going to bring to you very soon across Off the Ball. He's going to be coaching at Kieran Donaghy's Be a Star basketball camp in Kerry next week as well. Here's Hopla talking about working with Michael Jordan.
You can see by the top you've on Michael Jordan, you're a brand ambassador for the Jordan brand. One of my idols going up, come fly with me, airtime.
Yeah, I read the book there.
He was my guy. I saw him once and I kind of just touched his hand as he was getting onto the bus. He played golf in Tralee Golf Club one time.
You rode your bike.
Yeah, he was.
I read your book.
I cycled out there to meet the guy. So he was. Obviously an icon of mine. What's it like to meet him and be involved with him? And
I'll tell you
what kind of an aura, you know, you hear these iconic sports people, Tiger Woods is, he's one of them,
right? He's like, you know, he's like a god, you know, I mean, people put him on a pedestal. And I did a Jordan tour, European tour with him, and I actually felt a little sorry for him. I said, that man lives in a golden prison.
Yeah,
he has everything, but he can't just go out and like enjoy himself without having bodyguards, security, and everything. And we were in a restaurant in Berlin, and I was sitting with Rich Shoebrooks, Marin Sedlacek, all of the coaches that we did the Jordan clinic for. And we're sitting there, and then all of a sudden these three big guys come in. We're like, that looks like, you know, Jordan's bodyguards. And sure enough, they were. They had a case to join out, and all of a sudden they put Michael Jordan sitting in the corner by himself, and then his bodyguards. So I'm saying, there's Michael Jordan here in the restaurant. He's looking at the behinds of his three bodyguards. I mean, just by himself,
yeah,
you know.
Tough.
And I felt like, you know, it's really tough. But the same thing when we did the clinics in the camps, Michael would present the MVP trophy, but he had to watch the games in the back. He couldn't sit out on the court to watch them because it would take away from the kids. There's Michael Jordan, and they wouldn't watch kids. So he had to sit in the back, watch it on closed circuit TV, and then come out and make the award and, you know, on to the next site. OTB
AM. Okay. Phil is here. Phil, good morning to you. How are you
morning.
Doing?
Welcome back, Owen.
Thank you very much.
Did you bring the selection of the Japanese sweets?
Yeah, what did you bring?
So, this whole idea of bringing sweets back for the office is an absolute nonsense, I'm concerned.
I agree with him.
Absolute nonsense. It's like, oh, look at me, I was in this fantastic place. When you asked me about my exotic holiday, everyone, all staff email.
You were working, and we all knew you were there because you were producing content every day. And Japanese confectionery is like weird and brilliant, and you should have brought some of it back for us all to sample.
You know what? I've spoken enough about my trip, and I don't want to be like sending an all staff. Like anybody,
it's not all staff. You just leave it there. You don't even have to send around the all staff.
Anybody gets.
They're all going to work out that Japanese writing is Japanese confectionery brought home by the man who was just in Japan.
Anybody who gets an all staff email this week or any week, and it says sweets from Spain or the airport left in the kitchen. Translation of that all-staff email is, look at me, I went on holidays, give me attention.
Everybody gets 20 days off a year. It's fine.
You don't need
we all
to,
know that.
Yeah. And you don't need to look for attention for it. Like, go,
I'm not looking for attention. It's
go,
called...
Go to your holidays.
Decent, common human decency.
There is.
Which you clearly suddenly
Japanese
somehow are lacking.
In the office, though.
There's what?
There is Japanese sweets in the office.
Who brought them?
Yeah, that was me.
Did you?
Oh.
I'm presuming it must have been Ronan Mullen.
Oh, it could have been,
I tried one of them. And wasn't bad.
We should do like a whole team Sheehan sushi where they're trying the hard candies.
Yeah, hard candies are the worst. Really, really bad. I hope they are. I hope they're not them. What is it, chocolate or something?
It was kind of like seemed like it was a nut, and then you bit into it, and all of a sudden it was sweet. It kind of caught me off. It caught me off guard.
Usually the nut is on the inside.
Yeah, no, this was a
not how they did this
on the inside.
Yeah,
all
absolutely.
Right. I brought some Hershey's back from Annapolis when we were over at the Navy game, but primarily so I could just gorge on them in the office. Didn't send the all staff, just leave it sitting there. People can discover them. I ate most of them. That's how it works, Owen. That's like...
I could have brought a few like 7-Eleven sandwiches back with no crust on them. See how you like them. You want real Japanese culture?
Yeah.
Here's a 7-Eleven ham and cheese sandwich.
What about the hot dogs?
Carry through your handbag.
The hot dogs and 7-Eleven?
Yeah.
It's more the sausage and steak.
Skewers.
And also...
Is that the sausage and steak?
What's the... Oh, my God. My brain's deserting me. The classic American...
Corn dog.
Corn dog. Right.
Corn dog's a bit weird. Someone's mice getting feedback there. They're your earphones, Phil.
That could have been me, yeah.
You can stick the one on the right in if you want.
Yeah.
Solve everything. 25 minutes past 9 this morning. Is there something happening in the world of sport?
There is. Well, we'll go back to what happened in the Champions League last night, because a lot of the big hitters were on target. Kylian Mbappe scored a hat-trick for PSG. Robert Lewandowski got 2 for Bayern. He scored 21 goals this season, he has now. The only surprise is that Cristiano Ronaldo didn't score. Paulo Dybala got both goals for Juve in a 2-1 win at home to Lokomotiv Moscow. Tottenham and Manchester City both scored 5 goals each. Spurs picked up their first win in Group B with a 5-0 win at home to Red Star Belgrade. Harry Kane and Heung-min Son both scored 2 each. But the general message from Harry Kane after the game was, you know, we're playing Liverpool on Sunday, so we'll see. Yeah. I actually think, I said to somebody in the office yesterday, the best thing for Liverpool is if Spurs go out and absolutely hammer Red Star Belgrade.
Could they get up for it?
They'll be thinking, oh yeah, we're back. And then Liverpool put them to the sword on Sunday at Anfield.
So it's a confident enough prediction there, Phil.
Yeah, well, City have 3 wins from 3. They beat Atalanta 5-1 in Group C. Raheem Sterling scored a hat-trick. He's scored 16 goals for club and country since the start of the season. But Phil Foden was sent off late on. And tonight, Liverpool are away to Genk in Group E. Mo Salah's back. He missed the Manchester United game due to an ankle injury. But Trent Alexander-Arnold and Joe Matip didn't travel. So you would imagine Lovren and Joe Gomez come into that back four. And Klopp again was talking about Naby Keita. Came on Sunday. He actually had a little... Like, he did play the ball to Robertson for the Lallana equaliser. But we're still waiting for Naby Keita to kind of arrive at Liverpool.
Was he not good down the stretch last season?
Yeah, and then he got injured. Like, you're looking for the player that they signed from Leipzig, who, when he gets the ball, can dribble by players, go through defences and actually score goals. We haven't seen that yet, but Klopp was talking about it yesterday. Maybe, you know, now is the time to start giving him some opportunities. He seems to be over his injuries, and he could be the difference, because we're often told about the Liverpool midfield three, how they don't create enough,
yeah,
even though Liverpool create through their wing-backs. But yeah, when he's good, he's good. 5-6, Chelsea play Ajax in Amsterdam in Group H. No N'Golo Kante for Chelsea. Should mention the Liverpool game is at 8. I didn't really feel there was many great games last night, but tonight's games, coupled maybe to watch out for Inter and Dortmund. I think Salzburg and Napoli will be a decent one as well. Salzburg have been pretty impressive. St. Pat's won 3-1 away to Derry City in the SSC, or Tricity League Premier Division. So they've kept their slim hopes of European football alive. So Derry are still fourth. Top four will get European football because Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers, who are both in the top four, play in the cup final. So Derry are 4, 2 points ahead of Pat's. Much better goal difference. Derry finished with a home game against Finn Harps on Friday. Pat's are away to Dundalk. The Ireland rugby squad arrived home from Japan last night following their quarterfinal exit from the World Cup last Saturday, and the message from Joe Schmidt was they lost their rhythm throughout the year by putting too much focus on the World Cup. Also says he would be open to a return to the game next summer. He wants some time off. 6.5 years, he said. Doesn't think he's had a full day off since. Wales are confident that Jonathan Davis and Hadley Parks will both be fit in time for Sunday's semi-final against South Africa. Davis was a late withdrawal before the France game. Parks has been playing with a broken bone in his hand and a shoulder knock. And obviously Owen Lane was called up earlier this week instead of the injured Josh Navidi. And Dunamar was called time in his inter-county career after 6 years with the Tipperary Hurlers. Part of the panel that won the All-Ireland this year. He was also involved in the 2016 winning team as well.
All right, I want to play you this. It's Matt Williams on Monday night. Here's what he had to say about Ireland's setup against New Zealand.
It doesn't matter, Jared. Or seeing as we've known each other for 5 minutes, I should really be calling you Gilly.
Okay. Yeah, I think.
Gilly, mate, we have wonderful human beings playing rugby union for our country. Let's not forget that. But we need front foot, go forward ball for our immensely talented backs who are not being used.
What did you think?
That was very good.
It's your first reaction. I didn't realise you weren't on last week when it happened, were you?
No, I was on the plane.
Failed.
You can if you're as obscenely jealous of him as.
Yeah, better shirt, I thought.
But what's that sensation like when you actually hear yourself, but it's not you? I didn't say those words. It's kind of like a drunk video being played back. And you're like, God, I didn't say that today.
How's that Uber?
Yeah, exactly.
You were extracting cosmic revenge on the universe, basically. And when everybody came up to you and said, oh, don't put me on, you were like, too late, buddy. I've got no qualms about this.
It's a good feeling. Sorry, back to you and Gilly.
No, because I want to... So, Stacked with Lads, Carnage. You had Breffni before Breffni was Breffni.
Yes.
This was your one journalistic failing of the whole thing, right?
Yeah, I had the first
great,
interview
The
Breffni.
White whale that went away and you didn't use it. Why didn't you use it? He asked you not to?
He asked me not to. He said that his employer didn't want him doing any more videos after he went mega viral. You know, maybe if like a producer back at base said, we need that GEA video tomorrow, not for next week, then I would have done it. No, it was totally my fault.
So he was part of the GEA club, was it? Is that it?
Yeah, he was at GEA training. And just chatting with him, really nice guy. That's actually one of the things that irks me about the thing as well, is that this guy was like, because of one soundbite, everybody just kind of completely ripped the piss out of him online, and like people going up to him, like ripping the piss out of him over there and stuff like that. Very, very sound fella. Works for an aviation company over in Tokyo. Was at GEA training. I interviewed a few of them. The video's up online. And he did say the same thing to me. I was like, so you're obviously looking forward to the rugby and stuff, because he would have played rugby back home. And he's like, yeah, I got a load of rock lads coming over to our apartment. He didn't say Stacked with Lads to me, but he said it's going to be Carnage. And he says Roppongi is where it's going to be at. And it probably would have made the cut, except he got in touch saying, listen to that interview you did. My boss doesn't want me doing any more interviews.
Is he good at GA? Is he good player?
Yeah, he actually did. He looked handy enough, actually, yeah. But he says,
did you talk out? Did you get out? Oh, I'm here now, I'm going to do a bit of this.
I would love to, absolutely love to, but nobody gave me the opportunity to talk out. You can't just like say, yeah, I'm here, work for a media organisation back in Dublin, and also I'm your new teammate. They were in big training for the Asian Games.
Rock up with a GoPro on, say I'm here.
Yeah, exactly, could have done that. Didn't have the equipment, Phil.
Right, good stuff. Finished?
Yeah, all good.
Nice one. Right, all this week on OTBM, we're giving the chance to win UEFA Champions League quarterfinal tickets, as always, thanks to Pepsi Max, one of the proud sponsors of the UEFA Champions League. Our daily winner each morning will go into Friday's draw. There's also a daily prize of a Pepsi Max promotional prize. This morning we asked you to name each of the Irish Champions League winners since the 1990s, and the winner is Peter Scully. Bit of controversy around this one. Roy Keane obviously missed the final, still gets the medal. Dennis Irwin, John O'Shea, Steve Finnan, Kevin Keller, all fairly obvious. Kevin Keller might have been one that kept you out. Darren Potter played in the round of 16 in 2005 versus Leverkusen, so he gets a medal.
Yeah, he was there, yeah. Remember the pitch invader as well, the mysterious pitch invader that got into the Liverpool team photo.
Oh, yeah. In the warm-up?
No, after they won.
After they won.
Yeah, he got a tracksuit and he arrived on. There was a part of a documentary where his dad was on and he was on it as well.
Go check out pepsimax.ie for more chances to win. Pepsi Max have got up to 20 tickets up for grabs to Champions League group games. Pepsi Max, maximum taste, no sugar. That's it from us this morning on OTBM. Thanks very much for joining us. Stay tuned to the Off The Ball channels and OTB Sports Radio throughout the day. If you've missed anything from OTBM this morning, we had rugby with Gregor Paul, we had football with Jamie Delaney, the sports pages. You can check the podcast back on the offtheball.com/podcast or the Go Loud app. Watch it back on our YouTube channel and subscribe. Tonight on Off The Ball from 7 o'clock, Brian O'Driscoll on Wednesday Night Rugby, I presume talking about the putt, Champions League with Damien Delaney and much more. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 8 p.m. at 7:30. Good luck.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.